the Light Lasts, and Other Stories, by Agatha Christie. Read by Isla Blair. While the Light Lasts. The Ford car bumped from rut to rut, and the hot African sun poured down unmercifully. On either side of the so-called road stretched an unbroken line of trees and scrub, rising and falling in gently undulating lines as far as the eye could reach, the colouring a soft, deep yellow-green, the whole effect languorous and strangely quiet. Few birds stirred the slumbering silence. Once a snake wriggled across the road in front of the car, escaping the driver's efforts at destruction with sinuous ease. Once a native stepped out from the bush, dignified and upright. Behind him, a woman with an infant bound closely to her broad back, and complete household equipment, including a frying pan, balanced magnificently on her head. All these things George Crozier had not failed to point out to his wife, who had answered him with a monosyllabic lack of attention which irritated him. "Thinking of that fellow," he deduced wrathfully. It was thus that he was wont to allude in his mind to Deirdre Crozier's first husband, killed in the first year of the war. Killed, too, in the campaign against German West Africa. Natural she should, perhaps. He stole a glance at her. Her fairness, the pink and white smoothness of her cheek, the rounded lines of her figure, rather more rounded, perhaps, than they had been in those far-off days when she'd passively permitted him to become engaged to her, and then, in that first emotional scare of war, had abruptly cast him aside and made a war wedding of it with that lean, sunburnt boy lover of hers, Tim Nugent. Well, well, the fellow was dead. Gallantly dead. And he, George Crozier, had married the girl he had always meant to marry. She was fond of him, too. How could she help it, when he was ready to gratify her every wish, and had the money to do it, too? He reflected with some complacency on his last gift to her, at Kimberley, where, owing to his friendship with some of the directors of De Beers, he had been able to purchase a diamond which, in the ordinary way, would not have been in the market. A stone not remarkable as to size, but of a very exquisite and rare shade, a peculiar deep amber, almost old gold, a diamond such as you might not find in 100 years. And the look in her eyes when he gave it to her. Women were all the same about diamonds. The necessity of holding on with both hands to prevent himself being jerked out brought George Crozier back to the realities. He cried out, for perhaps the 14th time, with the pardonable irritation of a man who owns 2 Rolls-Royce cars and who's exercised his stud on the highways of civilization. "Good Lord, what a car! What a road!" he went on angrily. "Where the devil is this tobacco estate, anyway? It's over 30 minutes since we left Bulawayo." "Lost in Rhodesia," said Deirdre lightly, between 2 involuntary leaps into the air. But the coffee-coloured driver appealed to responded with the cheering news that their destination was just round the next bend of the road. The manager of the estate, Mr. Walters, was waiting on the stoop to receive them with a touch of deference due to George Crozier's prominence in Union Tobacco. He introduced his daughter-in-law, who shepherded Deirdre through the cool, dark inner hall to a bedroom beyond, where she could remove the veil with which she was always careful to shield her complexion when motoring. As she unfastened the pins in her usual leisurely, graceful fashion, Deirdre's eyes swept round the whitewashed ugliness of the bare room. No luxuries here. And Deirdre, who loved comfort as a cat loves cream, shivered a little. On the wall, a text confronted her. "What shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" it demanded of all and sundry, and Deirdre, pleasantly conscious that the question had nothing to do with her, turned to accompany her shy and rather silent guide. She noted, but not in the least maliciously, the spreading hips and the unbecoming cheap cotton gown, and with a glow of quiet appreciation, her eyes dropped the exquisite, costly simplicity of her own French white linen. Beautiful clothes, especially when worn by herself, roused in her the joy of the artist. The 2 men were waiting for her.
"It won't bore you to come round too, Mrs. Crozier."
"Not at all. I've never been over a tobacco factory." They stepped out into the still Rhodesian afternoon. "These are seedlings here. We plant them out as required. You see..." The manager's voice droned on,
interpolated by her husband's sharp, staccato questions. Output, stamp duty, problems of coloured labour. She ceased to listen. This was Rhodesia. This was the land Tim had loved, for he and she were to have gone together after the war was over. If he'd not been killed. As always, the bitterness of revolt surged up in her at that thought. 2 short months. That was all they had. 2 months of happiness. If that mingled rapture and pain were happiness, was love ever happiness? Did not 1,000 tortures beset the lover's heart? She had lived intensely in that short space. But had she ever known the peace, the leisure, the quiet contentment of her present life? And for the first time she admitted, somewhat unwillingly, that perhaps all had been for the best. I wouldn't have liked living out here. I mightn't have been able to make Tim happy. I might have disappointed him. George loves me, and I'm very fond of him, and he's very, very good to me. Why, look at that diamond he bought me only the other day. And thinking of it, her eyelids drooped a little in pure pleasure. This is where we thread the leaves. Walters led the way into a long, low shed. On the floor were vast heaps of green leaves, and white-clad black boys squatted round them, picking and rejecting with deft fingers, sorting them into sizes, and stringing them by means of primitive needles on a long line of string. They worked with cheerful leisureliness, jesting amongst themselves, and showing their white teeth as they laughed. Now, out here... They passed through the shed into the daylight again, for the lines of leaves hung drying in the sun. Deirdre sniffed delicately the faint, almost imperceptible fragrance that filled the air. Walters led the way into other sheds, where the tobacco, kissed by the sun into faint yellow discoloration, underwent its further treatment. Dark here, with the brown swinging masses above, ready to fall to powder at a rough touch. The fragrance was stronger, almost overpowering, it seemed to Deirdre, and suddenly a sort of terror came upon her, a fear of she knew not what, that drove her from that menacing scented obscurity out into the sunlight. Crozier noted her pallor.
"What's wrong, my dear? Don't you feel well? The sun, perhaps. Better not come round the plantations with us, hm?"
Walters was solicitous. Mrs. Crozier had better go back to the house and rest. He called to a man a little distance away.
"Mr. Arden, Mrs. Crozier's feeling a little done up with the heat. Just take her back to the house, will you?"
The momentary feeling of dizziness was passing. Deirdre walked by Arden's side. She had yet hardly glanced at him. Deirdre. Her heart gave a leap, and then stood still. Only one person had ever spoken her name like that, with a faint stress on the first syllable that made of it a caress. She turned and stared at the man by her side. He was burnt, almost black by the sun. He walked with a limp, and on the cheek nearer hers was a long scar which altered his expression. But she knew him. Tim! For an eternity, it seemed to her, they gazed at each other, mute and trembling, and then, without knowing how or why, they were in each other's arms. Time rolled back for them. Then they drew apart again, and Deirdre, conscious, as she put it, of the idiocy of the question, said, "Then you're not dead?" "No. They must have mistaken another chap for me. I was badly knocked in the head, but I came to and managed to crawl into the bush. After that, I don't know what happened for months and months, but a friendly tribe looked after me, and at last I got my proper wits again and managed to get back to civilization." He paused. "I found you'd been married 6 months." Deirdre cried out, "Oh, Tim, understand, please, understand. It was so awful, the loneliness and the poverty. I didn't mind being poor with you, but when I was alone, I hadn't the nerve to stand up against the sordidness of it all." "It's all right, Deirdre. I did understand. I know you always have a hankering after the fleshpots. I took you from them once, but the second time, well, my nerve failed. I was pretty badly broken up, you see, and could hardly walk without a crutch, and then there was this scar." She interrupted impassionately. "Do you think I would have cared for that?" "No, I know you wouldn't. I was a fool. Some women did mind, you know. I made up my mind I'd manage to get a glimpse of you. If you looked happy, if I thought you were contented to be with Crozier, why then I'd remain dead. I did see you. You were just getting into a big car. You had on some lovely sable furs, things I'd never have been able to give you if I worked my fingers to the bone and... Well, you seemed happy enough. I hadn't the same strength and courage, the same belief in myself that I'd had before the war. All I could see was myself, broken and useless, barely able to earn enough money to keep you. And you looked so beautiful, Deirdre. Such a queen amongst women, so worthy to have furs and jewels and lovely clothes and all the 101 luxuries Crozier could give you. That, and well, the pain of seeing you together decided me. Everyone believed me dead. I would stay dead. Pain, repeated Deirdre in a low voice. Oh, damn it all, Deirdre. It hurt. It isn't that I blame you. I don't. But it hurt. They were both silent. Then Tim raised her face to his and kissed it with a new tenderness. But that's all over now, sweetheart. The only thing to decide is how we're going to break it to Crozier. Oh! She drew herself away abruptly. I hadn't thought... She broke off as Crozier and the manager appeared round the angle of the path. With a swift turn of her head, she whispered, Do nothing now. Leave it to me. I must prepare him. Where could I meet you tomorrow? Nugent reflected.
I could come into Bulawayo. How about the cafe near the Standard Bank? At 3 o'clock it would be pretty empty.
Deirdre gave a brief nod of assent before turning her back on him and joining the other two men. Tim Nugent looked after her with a faint frown. Something in her manner puzzled him.
Deirdre was very silent during the drive home. Sheltering behind the fiction of a touch of the sun, she deliberated on her course of action.
How should she tell him? How would he take it?
A strange lassitude seemed to possess her, and a growing desire to postpone the revelation as long as might be.
Tomorrow would be soon enough. There would be plenty of time before 3 o'clock.
The hotel was uncomfortable. Their room was on the ground floor, looking out onto an inner court. Deirdre stood that evening, sniffing the stale air and glancing distastefully at the tawdry furniture. Her mind flew to the easy luxury of Monkton Court amidst the Surrey Pinewoods. When her maid left her at last, she went slowly to her jewel case. In the palm of her hand, the golden diamond returned her stare. With an almost violent gesture, she returned it to the case and slammed down the lid. Tomorrow morning, she would tell George. She slept badly. It was stifling beneath the heavy folds of the mosquito netting. She awoke white and listless. Impossible to start a scene so early in the day. She lay in the small, close room all morning, resting. Lunchtime came upon her with a sense of shock. As they sat drinking coffee, George Crozier proposed a drive to the Mattapos.
Plenty of time if we start at once.
Deirdre shook her head, pleading a headache, and she thought to herself, That settles it. I can't rush the thing. After all, what does a day more or less matter? I'll explain to Tim. She waved goodbye to Crozier as he rattled off in the battered Ford. Then, glancing at her watch, she walked slowly to the meeting place. The cafe was deserted at this hour. They sat down at a little table and ordered the inevitable tea that South Africa drinks at all hours of the day and night. Neither of them said a word till the waitress brought it and withdrew to her fastness behind some pink curtains. Then Deirdre looked up and started as she met the intense watchfulness in his eyes.
Deirdre, have you told him?
She shook her head, moistening her lips, seeking for words that would not come.
Why not?
I haven't had a chance. There hasn't been time.
Even to herself, the words sounded halting and unconvincing.
It's not that. There's something else. I suspected it yesterday. I'm sure of it today.
Deirdre, what is it?
She shook her head dumbly. There's some reason why you don't want to leave George Crozier, why you don't want to come back to me. What is it? It was true. As he said it, she knew it. Knew it with sudden, scorching shame, but knew it beyond any possibility of doubt. And still his eyes searched her. It isn't that you love him, you don't. But there's something, she thought. In another moment he'll see. Oh, God, don't let him. Suddenly his face whitened. Deirdre, is it that there's going to be a child? In a flash, she saw the chance he offered her. A wonderful way. Slowly, almost without her own volition, she bowed her head. She heard his quick breathing, then his voice, rather high and hard.
That alters things. I didn't know. We've got to find a different way out.
He leant across the table and caught both her hands in his. Deirdre, my darling, never think, never dream that you were in any way to blame. Whatever happens, remember that. I should have claimed you when I came back to England. I funked it. So it's up to me to do what I can to put things straight now. You see? Whatever happens, don't fret, darling. Nothing has been your fault. He lifted first one hand, then the other, to his lips. Then she was alone, staring at the untasted tea. And strangely enough, it was only one thing that she saw. A gaudily illuminated text hanging on a whitewashed wall. The words seemed to spring out from it and hurl themselves at her. What shall it profit a man? She got up, paid for her tea, and went out. On his return, George Crozier was met by a request that his wife might not be disturbed. Her headache, the maid said, was very bad. It was 9 o'clock the next morning when he entered her bedroom, his face rather grave. Deirdre was sitting up in bed. She looked white and haggard, but her eyes shone. George, I've got something to tell you. Something rather terrible. He interrupted her brusquely. So you've heard. I was afraid it might upset you. Upset me? Yes. You talked to the poor young fellow that day. He saw her hand steal to her heart, her eyelids flicker. Then she said in a low, quick voice that somehow frightened him, I've heard nothing. Tell me quickly. I thought, tell me. Out at that tobacco estate. Chap shot himself. Badly broken up in the war, nerves all to pieces, I suppose. There's no other reason to account for it. He shot himself in that dark shed. Where the tobacco was hanging. She spoke with certainty, her eyes like a sleepwalker's, as she saw before her in the odorous darkness a figure lying there, revolver in hand. Why, to be sure, that's where you were taken queer yesterday. Odd thing, that. Deirdre did not answer. She saw another picture, a table with tea things on it, and a woman bowing her head in acceptance of a lie.
Well, well, the war has a lot to answer for, said Crozier, and stretched out his hand for a match, lighting his pipe with careful puffs.
His wife's cry startled him. Oh, don't, don't! I can't bear the smell! He stared at her in kindly astonishment. My dear girl, you mustn't be nervy. After all, you can't escape from the smell of tobacco. You'll meet it everywhere. Yes. Everywhere. She smiled a slow, twisted smile, and murmured some words that he did not catch, words that she had chosen for the original obituary notice of Tim Nugent's death. While the light lasts, I shall remember, and in the darkness, I shall not forget. Her eyes widened as they followed the ascending spiral of smoke, and she repeated in a low, monotonous voice, Everywhere.
The actress.
The shabby man in the fourth row of the pit bent forward and stared incredulously at the stage. His shifty eyes narrowed furtively.
Nancy Taylor, he muttered. Father Lord, little Nancy Taylor.
His glance dropped to the programme in his hand. One name was printed slightly larger type than the rest.
Olga Stormer. So that's what she calls herself.
Fancy yourself a star, don't you, my lady?
And you must be making a pretty little pot of money, too.
Quite forgotten your name ever was.
Nancy Taylor, I dare say.
I wonder now
what you'd say if Jake Levitt should remind you of the fact.
The curtain fell on the close of the first act. Hearty applause filled the auditorium. Olga Stormer, the great emotional actress whose name in a few short years had become a household word, was adding yet another triumph to her list of successes as Cora in The Avenging Angel. Jake Levitt did not join in the clapping, but a slow, appreciative grin gradually distended his mouth.
Ah, what luck. Just when he was on his beam ends, too. She tried to bluff it out, I suppose, but she couldn't put it over on him. Properly worked, the thing was a gold mine.
On the following morning, the first workings of Jake Levitt's gold mine became apparent. In her drawing room, with its red lacquer and black hangings, Olga Stormer read and reread the letter thoughtfully. Her pale face, with its exquisitely mobile features, was a little more set than usual, and every now and then the grey-green eyes under the level brows steadily envisaged the middle distance, as though she contemplated the threat behind rather than the actual words of the letter. In that wonderful voice of hers, which would throb with emotion or be as clear-cut as the click of a typewriter, Olga called, "Miss Jones!" A neat young woman with spectacles, a shorthand pad and pencil clasped in her hand, hastened from an adjoining room.
"Ring up Mr. Danahan, please, and ask him to come round immediately."
Sid Danahan, Olga Stormer's manager, entered the room with the usual apprehension of a man whose life it is to deal with and overcome the vagaries of the artistic female. To coax, to soothe, to bully, one at a time or all together, such was his daily routine. To his relief, Olga appeared calm and composed, and merely flicked a note across the table to him. "Read that." The letter was scrawled in an illiterate hand on cheap paper.
"Dear Madam, I much appreciated your performance in The Avenging Angel last night. I fancy we have a mutual friend in Miss Nancy Taylor, late of Chicago. An article regarding her is to be published shortly. If you would care to discuss same, I could call upon you at any time convenient to yourself. Yours respectfully, Jake Levitt."
Danahan looked slightly bewildered. I don't quite get it. Who is this Nancy Taylor?"
"A girl who'll be better dead, Danny." There was a bitterness in her voice and a weariness that revealed her 34 years. "A girl who was dead until this carrion crow brought her to life again."
"Oh, then me, Danny. Just me."
"This means blackmail, of course."
She nodded.
"Of course. And by a man who knows the art thoroughly."
Danahan frowned, considering the matter. Olga, her cheek pillowed on a long, slender hand, watched him with unfathomable eyes.
"What about bluff? Deny everything. He can't be sure that he hasn't been misled by a chance resemblance."
Olga shook her head. "Levitt makes his living by blackmailing women. He's sure enough."
"The police?"
hinted Danahan doubtfully. Her faint, derisive smile was answer enough. Beneath her self-control, though he did not guess it, was the impatience of a keen brain watching a slower brain laboriously cover the ground it had already traversed in a flash.
"You don't, think it might be wise for you to say something yourself to Sir Richard? That would partly spike his guns."
The actress's engagement to Sir Richard Everard, MP, had been announced a few weeks previously.
"I told Richard everything when he asked me to marry him."
"My word, that was clever of you," said Danahan admiringly.
Olga smiled a little.
"It wasn't cleverness, Danny, dear. You wouldn't understand. All the same, if this man Levitt does what he threatens, My number is up. And incidentally, Richard's parliamentary career goes smash too. No, as far as I can see, there are only two things to do.
Well?
To pay. And that, of course, is endless. Or to disappear, start again. The weariness again was very apparent in her voice. It isn't even as though I've done anything I regretted. I was a half-starved little gutter waif, Danny, striving to keep straight. I shot a man, a beast of a man who deserved to be shot. The circumstances under which I killed him were such that no jury on earth would have convicted me. I know that now, but at the time I was only a frightened kid and I ran. Danahan nodded.
I suppose, he said doubtfully, there's nothing against this man Levitt we could get hold of.
Olga shook her head. Whew, very unlikely. He's too much of a coward to go in for evil doing. The sound of her own words seemed to strike her. A coward? I wonder if he couldn't work on that in some way.
If Sir Richard were to see him and frighten him, suggested Danahan. Richard is too fine an instrument. You can't handle that sort of man with gloves on. Well, let me see him.
Forgive me, Danny, but I don't think you're subtle enough. Something between gloves and bare fists is needed. Let us say mittens. And that means a woman. Yes, I rather fancy a woman might do the trick. A woman with a certain amount of finesse, but who knows the baser side of life from bitter experience. Olga Stormer, for instance. Don't talk to me. I've got a plan coming. She leant forward, burying her face in her hands. She lifted it suddenly. What's the name of that girl who wants to understudy me? Margaret Ryan, isn't it? The girl with hair like mine.
Her hair's all right, admitted Danahan grudgingly, his eyes resting on the bronze-gold coil surrounding Olga's head. It's just like yours, as you say, but oh, she's no good any other way. I was going to sack her next week.
If all goes well, you'll probably have to let her understudy Cora. She smothered his protests with a wave of her hand. Danny, answer me one question honestly. Do you think I can act? Really act, I mean. Or am I just an attractive woman who trails around in pretty dresses?
Act? My God, Olga, there's been nobody like you since Dusa.
Then if Levitt really is a coward, as I suspect, the thing will come off. No, I'm not going to tell you about it. I want you to get hold of the Ryan girl. Tell her I'm interested in her and want her to dine here tomorrow night.
She'll come fast enough. I should say she would.
The other thing I want is some good, strong knockout props, something that will put anyone out of action for an hour or two, but leave them none the worse the next day. Danahan grinned.
I can't guarantee our friend won't have a headache, but there will be no permanent damage done.
Good. Run away now, Danny, and leave the rest to me. She raised her voice. Miss Jones! The spectacled young woman appeared with her usual alacrity. Take this down, please. Walking slowly up and down, Olga dictated the day's correspondence, but one answer she wrote with her own hand. Jake Levitt, in his dingy room, grinned as he tore open the expected envelope. Dear Sir, I cannot recall the lady of whom you speak, but I meet so many people that my memory is necessarily uncertain. I am always pleased to help any fellow actress, and shall be at home if you call this evening at 9 o'clock. Yours faithfully, Olga Stormer. Levitt nodded appreciatively.
Clever note.
She admitted nothing. Nevertheless, she was willing to treat.
A gold mine was developing.
At 9 o'clock precisely, Levitt stood outside the door of the actress's flat and pressed the bell. No one answered the summons, and he was about to press it again when he realized that the door was not latched. He pushed the door open and entered the hall. To his right was an open door leading into a brilliantly lighted room, a room decorated in scarlet and black. Levitt walked in. On the table under the lamp lay a sheet of paper on which were written the words, "Please wait until I return, O Stormer." Levitt sat down and waited.
In spite of himself, a feeling of uneasiness was stealing over him. The flat was so very quiet. There was something eerie about the silence. Nothing wrong, of course. How could there be? But the room was so deadly quiet, and yet, quiet as it was, he had the preposterous, uncomfortable notion that he wasn't alone in it. Absurd. He wiped the perspiration from his brow, and still the impression grew stronger. He wasn't alone. With a muttered oath, he sprang up and began to pace up and down. In a minute the woman would return, and then... He stopped dead with a muffled cry. From beneath the black velvet hangings that draped the window, a hand protruded. He stooped and touched it. Cold. Horribly cold. A dead hand. With a cry, he flung back the curtains. A woman was lying there. One arm flung wide, the other doubled under her as she lay face downwards, her golden bronze hair lying in dishevelled masses on her neck. Olga Stormer! Tremblingly, his fingers sought the icy coldness of that wrist and felt for the pulse. As he thought, there was none. She was dead. She had escaped him then, by taking the simplest way out. Suddenly his eyes were arrested by two ends of red cord, finishing in fantastic tassels, and half hidden by the masses of her hair. He touched them gingerly. The head sagged as he did so, and he caught a glimpse of a horrible purple face. He sprang back with a cry, his head whirling. There was something here he did not understand. His brief glimpse of her face, disfigured as it was, had shown him one thing. This was murder, not suicide. The woman had been strangled, and she was not Olga Stormer. What was that? A sound behind him. He wheeled round and looked straight into the terrified eyes of a maidservant crouching against the wall. Her face was as white as the cap and apron she wore, but he did not understand the fascinated horror in her eyes until her half-breathed words enlightened him to the peril in which he stood. Oh, my God! You've killed her! Even then, he did not quite realize. He replied, No, no, she was dead when I found her. I saw you do it. You pulled the cord and strangled her. I heard the gurgling cry she gave. The sweat broke out upon his brow in earnest. His mind went rapidly over his actions of the previous few minutes. She must have come in just as he had the two ends of cord in his hands. She had seen the sagging head and had taken his own cry as coming from the victim. He stared at her helplessly. There was no doubting what he saw on her face, terror and stupidity. She would tell the police she had seen the crime committed, and no cross-examination would shake her. He was sure of that. She would swear away his life with the unshakable conviction that she was speaking the truth. What a horrible, unforeseen chain of circumstances. Stop. Was it unforeseen? Was there some devilry here? On an impulse, he said, eyeing her narrowly. That's not your mistress, you know. Her answer, given mechanically, threw a light upon the situation. No. It's her actress friend. If you call them friends, seeing that they fought like cat and dog... They were at it tonight, hammer and tongs. A trap. He saw it now.
Where's your mistress?
Went out 10 minutes ago. A trap. And he had walked into it like a lamb.
A clever devil, this Olga Stormer. She had rid herself of a rival, and he was to suffer for the deed.
Murder. My God, they hung a man for murder, and he was innocent, innocent.
A stealthy rustle recalled him. The little maid was sidling towards the door. Her wits were beginning to work again. Her eyes wavered to the telephone, then back to the door. At all costs, he must silence her. It was the only way, as well as hang for a real crime as a fictitious one. She had no weapon, neither had he, but he had his hands. Then his heart gave a leap. On the table beside her, almost under her hand, lay a small, jewelled revolver. If he could reach it first... Instinct, or his eyes, warned her.
She caught it up as he sprang and held it pointed at his breast. Awkwardly, as she held it, her finger was on the trigger, and she could hardly miss at that distance. He stopped dead. A revolver belonging to a woman like Olga Stormer would be pretty sure to be loaded. But there was one thing. She was no longer directly between him and the door. So long as he did not attack her, she might not have the nerve to shoot. Anyway, he must risk it. Zigzagging, he ran for the door, through the hall and out through the outer door, banging it behind him. He heard her voice faint and shaky, calling, "Police! Murder!" She'd have to call louder than that before anyone was likely to hear her. He got a start anyway. Down the stairs he went, running down the open street, then slackening to a walk as a stray pedestrian turned the corner. He had his plan cut and dried. To Gravesend, as quickly as possible. A boat was sailing from there that night for the remoter parts of the world. He knew the captain, a man who, for a consideration, would ask no questions. Once on board and out to sea, he would be safe. At 11 o'clock, Danahan's telephone rang. Olga's voice spoke. "Prepare a contract for Miss Ryan, will you? She's to understudy Cora. It's absolutely no use arguing. I owe her something after all the things I did to her tonight." "What?" "Yes, I think I'm out of my troubles. By the way, if she tells you tomorrow that I'm an ardent spiritualist and put her into a trance tonight, don't show open incredulity." "How?" "Knockout drops in the coffee, followed by scientific passes. After that, I painted her face with purple grease paint and put a tourniquet on her left arm." "Mystified?" "Well, you must stay mystified until tomorrow. I haven't time to explain now. I must get out of the cap and apron before my faithful Maud returns from the pictures. There was a beautiful drama on tonight, she told me. But she missed the best drama of all. I played my best part tonight, Danny. The mittens won. Jake Levitt is a coward, all right, and, oh, Danny, I'm an actress." The House of Dreams. This is the story of John Seagrave, of his life, which was unsatisfactory, of his love, which was unsatisfied, of his dreams, and of his death. And if in the two latter he found what was denied in the two former, then his life may, after all, be taken as a success. Who knows? John Seagrave came of a family which had been slowly going downhill for the last century. They'd been landowners since the days of Elizabeth, but their last piece of property was sold. It was thought well that one of the sons, at least, should acquire the useful art of money-making. It was an unconscious irony of fate that John should be the chosen one. With his strangely sensitive mouth and the long, dark blue slits of eyes that suggested an elf or a fawn, something wild and of the woods, it was incongruous that he should be offered up, sacrifice on the altar of finance. The smell of the earth, the taste of the sea salt on one's lips, and the free sky above one's head, these were the things beloved by John Seagrave, to which he was to bid farewell. At the age of 18, he became a junior clerk in a big business house. 7 years later, he was still a clerk, not quite so junior, but with status otherwise unchanged. The faculty for getting on in the world had been omitted from his makeup. He was punctual, industrious, plodding, a clerk, and nothing but a clerk. And yet he might have been what? He could hardly answer that question himself. But he could not rid himself of the conviction that somewhere there was a life in which he could have counted. There was power in him, swiftness of vision, something of which his fellow toilers had never had a glimpse. They liked him. He was popular because of his air of careless friendship. But they never appreciated the fact that he barred them by that same manner from any real intimacy. The dream came to him suddenly. It was no childish fantasy growing and developing through the years. It came on a midsummer night, or rather early morning, and he woke from it tingling all over,
striving to hold it to him as it fled, slipping from his clutch in the elusive way dreams have. Desperately, he clung to it. It must not go, it must not. He must remember the house. It was the house, of course. The house he knew so well. Was it a real house? Or did he merely know it in dreams? He didn't remember, but he certainly knew it. Knew it very well. The faint grey light of the early morning was stealing into the room. The stillness was extraordinary. At 4:30 a.m., London, weary London, found her brief instant of peace. John Seagrave lay quiet, wrapped in the joy, the exquisite wonder and beauty of his dream. How clever it had been of him to remember it. A dream flitted so quickly, as a rule, ran past you, just as with waking consciousness your clumsy fingers sought to stop and hold it. But he'd been too quick for this dream. He had seized it as it was slipping swiftly by him. It really was a most remarkable dream. There was the house, and his thoughts were brought up with a jerk, for when he came to think of it, he couldn't remember anything but the house. And suddenly, with a tinge of disappointment, he recognized that, after all, the house was quite strange to him. He hadn't even dreamed of it before. It was a white house, standing on high ground. There were trees near it, blue hills in the distance. But its peculiar charm was independent of surroundings, for, and this was the point, the climax of the dream, it was a beautiful, a strangely beautiful house. His pulse quickened as he remembered anew the strange beauty of the house. The outside of it, of course, for he hadn't been inside. There'd be no question of that, no question of it whatsoever. Then, as the dingy outlines of his bed-sitting room began to take shape in the growing light, he experienced the disillusion of the dreamer. Perhaps, after all, his dream hadn't been so very wonderful, or had the wonderful, the explanatory part, slipped past him, and laughed at his ineffectual clutching hands. A white house, standing on high ground. There wasn't much to get excited about, surely. It was rather a big house, he remembered, with a lot of windows in it, and the blinds were all down. Not because the people were away, he was sure of that, but because it was so early that no one was up yet. Then he laughed at the absurdity of his imaginings, and remembered that he was to dine with Mr. Wetterman that night. Maisie Wetterman was Rudolf Wetterman's only daughter, and she'd been accustomed all her life to having exactly what she wanted. Paying a visit to her father's office one day, she'd noticed John Seagrave. He had brought in some letters that her father had asked for. When he'd departed again, she asked her father about him. Wetterman was communicative.
One of Sir Edward Seagrave's sons. Fine old family, but on its last legs. This boy will never set the Thames on fire. Oh, I like him, all right, but there's nothing to him. No punch of any kind.
Maisie was perhaps indifferent to punch. It was a quality valued more by her parent than herself. Anyway, a fortnight later, she persuaded her father to ask John Seagrave to dinner. It was an intimate dinner, herself and her father, John Seagrave, and a girlfriend who was staying with her. The girlfriend was moved to make a few remarks.
On approval, I suppose, Maisie. Later, Father will do it up in a nice little parcel and bring it home from the city as a present to his dear little daughter, duly bought and paid for.
Oh, Allegra, you are the limit.
Allegra Kerr laughed.
You do take fancies, you know, Maisie. I like that hat. I must have it. If hats, why not husbands?
Don't be absurd. I've hardly spoken to him yet.
No, but you've made up your mind, said the other girl.
What's the attraction, Maisie?
I don't know, said Maisie Wetterman slowly. He's different.
Different?
Yes, I can't explain. He's good-looking, you know, in a queer sort of way, but it's not that. He's a way of not seeing you're there.
Really, I don't believe he as much as glanced at me that day in Father's office.
Allegra laughed.
That's an old trick. Rather an astute young man, I should say.
Oh, Allegra, you're hateful. Cheer up, darling. Father will buy a woolly lamb for his little Maisiekins.
I don't want it to be like that.
Love with a capital L, is that it?
Why shouldn't he fall in love with me?
No reason at all. I expect he will.
Allegra smiled as she spoke, and let her glance sweep over the other. Maisie Wetterman was short, inclined to be plump. She had dark hair, well shingled and artistically waved. Her naturally good complexion was enhanced by the latest colours in powder and lipstick. She had a good mouth and teeth, dark eyes, rather small and twinkly, and a jaw and chin slightly on the heavy side. She was beautifully dressed.
Yes, said Allegra, finishing her scrutiny. I've no doubt he will. The whole effect is really very good, Maisie.
A friend looked at her doubtfully.
I mean it, said Allegra. I mean it, honour bright.
But just supposing, for the sake of argument, that he shouldn't.
Fall in love, I mean. Suppose his affection to become sincere but platonic.
What then?
I may not like him at all when I know him better.
Quite so. On the other hand, you may like him very much indeed. And in the latter case...
Maisie shrugged her shoulders.
I should hope I've too much pride.
Allegra interrupted. Pride comes in handy for masking one's feelings. It doesn't stop you from feeling them.
Well, said Maisie, flushed, I don't see why I shouldn't say it. I am a very good match. I mean, from his point of view, father's daughter and everything.
Partnership in the offing, etc., said Allegra.
Yes, Maisie.
You're your father's daughter, all right.
I'm awfully pleased.
I do like my friends to run true to type.
The faint mockery of her tone made the other uneasy.
You are hateful, Allegra.
But stimulating, darling. That's why you have me here. I'm a student of history, you know, and it always intrigued me why the court jester was permitted and encouraged. Now that I'm one myself, I see the point. It's rather a good role, you see. I had to do something. There was I, proud and penniless, like the heroine of a novelette, well-born and badly educated. What to do, girl? God, what? Saith she. The poor relation type of girl, all willingness to do without a fire in her room, and content to do odd jobs and help dear cousin so-and-so. Nobody really wants her, except those people who can't keep their servants, and they treat her like a galley slave. So, I became the court fool. Insolence, plain speaking, a dash of wit now and again, not too much, lest I should have to live up to it, and behind it all, a very shrewd observation of human nature. People rather like being told how horrible they really are. That's why they flock to popular preachers. It's been a great success. I'm always overwhelmed with invitations. I can live on my friends with the greatest ease, and I'm careful to make no pretense of gratitude.
There's no one quite like you, Allegra. You don't mind in the least what you say.
That's where you're wrong.
I mind very much.
I take care and thought about the matter.
My seeming outspokenness is always calculated.
I've got to be careful. This job has got to carry me on to old age.
Why not marry? I know heaps of people who've asked you.
Allegra's face grew suddenly hard.
I can never marry.
Because...
Maisie left the sentence unfinished, looking at her friend. The latter gave a short nod of assent. Footsteps were heard on the stairs. The butler threw open the door and announced,
Mr. Seagrave.
John came in without any particular enthusiasm. He couldn't imagine why the old boy had asked him. If he could have got out of it, he would have done so. The house depressed him with its solid magnificence and the soft pile of its carpet. A girl came forward and shook hands with him. He remembered vaguely having seen her one day in her father's office.
How do you do, Mr. Seagrave? Mr. Seagrave? Miss Carr?
Then he woke.
Who was she? Where did she come from? From the flame-coloured draperies that floated round her to the tiny mercury wings on her small Greek head, she was a being transitory and fugitive, standing out against the dull background with an effect of unreality.
Rudolf Wetterman came in, his broad expanse of gleaming shirt front creaking as he walked. They went down informally to dinner. Allegra Carr talked to her host. John Seagrave had to devote himself to Maisie. But his whole mind was on the girl on the other side of him. She was marvellously effective. Her effectiveness was, he thought, more studied than natural. But behind all that, there lay something else. Flickering fire, fitful, capricious, like the will-o'-the-wisps that of old lured men into the marshes. At last he got a chance to speak to her. Maisie was giving her father a message from some friend she'd met that day. Now that the moment had come, he was tongue-tied. His glance pleaded with her dumbly.
"Dinner table topics," she said lightly. "Shall we start with the theatres, or with one of those innumerable openings beginning... Do you like..."
John laughed.
"And if we find we both liked dogs and disliked sandy cats, it will form what is called a bond between us."
"Assuredly," said Allegra gravely.
"It is, I think, a pity to begin with a catechism.
Yet it puts conversation within the reach of all."
"True, but with disastrous results."
"It is useful to know the rules, if only to break them." John smiled at her.
"I take it, then, that you and I will indulge our personal vagaries, even though we display thereby the genius that is akin to madness."
With a sharp, unguarded movement, the girl's hand swept a wine glass off the table. There was a tinkle of broken glass. Maisie and her father stopped talking.
"I'm so sorry, Mr. Wetman. I'm throwing glasses on the floor." "My dear Allegra, doesn't matter at all. Not at all."
Beneath his breath, John Seagrave said quickly,
"Broken glass. That's bad luck. I wish it hadn't happened."
"Don't worry. How does it go? Ill luck thou canst not bring where ill luck has its home."
She turned once more to Wetterman. John, resuming conversation with Maisie, tried to place the quotation. He got it at last. They were the words used by Sieglinder in the Valkyrie, when Sigmund offers to leave the house. He thought, did she mean... But Maisie was asking his opinion of the latest review. Soon he had admitted that he was fond of music.
"After dinner," said Maisie, "we'll make Allegra play for us."
They all went up to the drawing room together. Secretly, Wetterman considered it a barbarous custom. He liked the ponderous gravity of the wine passing round, the handed cigars. But perhaps it was as well tonight. He didn't know what on earth he could find to say to young Seagrave. Maisie was too bad with her whims. It wasn't as though the fellow were good-looking, really good-looking, and certainly he wasn't amusing. He was glad when Maisie asked Allegra Carr to play. They'd get through the evening sooner. The young idiot didn't even play bridge.
Allegra played well, though without the sure touch of a professional. She played modern music, Debussy and Strauss, a little Scriabin. Then she dropped into the first movement of Beethoven's Pathetique, that expression of a grief that is infinite, a sorrow that is endless and vast as the ages, but in which, from end to end, breathes the spirit that will not accept defeat. In the solemnity of undying woe, it moves with the rhythm of the conqueror to its final doom. Towards the end she faltered. Her fingers struck a discord, and she broke off abruptly. She looked across at Maisie and laughed mockingly.
"You see," she said, "they won't let me."
Then, without waiting for a reply to her somewhat enigmatical remark, she plunged into a strange, haunting melody, a thing of weird harmonies and curious, measured rhythm, quite unlike anything Seagrave had ever heard before. It was delicate as the flight of a bird, poised, hovering. Suddenly, without the least warning, it turned into a mere discordant jangle of notes, and Allegra rose laughing from the piano. In spite of her laugh, she looked disturbed and almost frightened. She sat down by Maisie, and John heard the latter say in a low tone to her, "You shouldn't do it. You really shouldn't do it."
"What was the last thing?"
John asked eagerly.
"Something of my own."
She spoke sharply and curtly. Wetterman changed the subject. That night, John Seagrave dreamt again of the house. John was unhappy. His life was irksome to him, as never before. Up to now, he accepted it patiently. A disagreeable necessity, but one which left his inner freedom essentially untouched. Now all that was changed. The outer world and the inner intermingled. He did not disguise to himself the reason for the change. He had fallen in love, at first sight, with Allegra Carr. What was he going to do about it? He'd been too bewildered that first night to make any plans. He'd not even tried to see her again. A little later, when Maisie Wetterman asked him down to her father's place in the country for the weekend, he went eagerly, but he was disappointed, for Allegra was not there. He mentioned her once, tentatively, to Maisie, and she told him that Allegra was up in Scotland paying a visit. He left it at that. He would have liked to go on talking about her, but the words seemed to stick in his throat. Maisie was puzzled by him that weekend. He didn't appear to see, well, to see what was so plainly to be seen. She was a direct young woman in her methods, but directness was lost upon John. He thought her kind, but a little overpowering. Yet the fates were stronger than Maisie. They willed that John should see Allegra again. They met in the park one Sunday afternoon. He had seen her from far off, and his heart thumped against the side of his ribs. Supposing she should have forgotten him. But she had not forgotten. She stopped and spoke. In a few minutes, they were walking side by side, striking out across the grass. He was ridiculously happy. He said suddenly and unexpectedly, "Do you believe in dreams?" "I believe in nightmares." The harshness of her voice startled him. "Nightmares?" he said stupidly. I didn't mean nightmares." Allegra looked at him. "No," she said. "There have been no nightmares in your life. I can see that." Her voice was gentle. Different. He told her then of his dream of the White House, stammering a little. He'd had it now seven times. Always the same. It was beautiful. So beautiful. He went on. "You see, it's to do with you, in some way. I had it first, the night before I met you." "To do with me?" She laughed, a short, bitter laugh. Oh no, that's impossible. The house was beautiful." "So are you," said John Seagrave. Allegra flushed a little with annoyance. "I'm sorry. I was stupid. I seemed to ask for a compliment, didn't I? But I didn't really mean that at all. The outside of me is all right, I know." "I haven't seen the inside of the house yet," said John Seagrave. "When I do, I know it will be quite as beautiful as the outside." He spoke slowly and gravely, giving the words a meaning that she chose to ignore. "There is something more I want to tell you, if you will listen."
"I will listen," said Allegra. "I am chucking up this job of mine. I ought to have done it long ago, I see that now. I've been content to drift along, knowing I was an utter failure, without caring much, just living from day to day. A man shouldn't do that. It's a man's business to find something he can do and make a success of it. I'm chucking this and taking on something else, quite a different sort of thing. It's a kind of expedition in West Africa. I can't tell you the details. They're not supposed to be known, but if it comes off, well, I shall be a rich man." "So you, too, count success in terms of money?" "Money," said John Seagrave, "means just one thing to me. You. When I come back..." He paused. She bent her head. Her face had grown very pale. "I won't pretend to misunderstand. That's why I must tell you now, once and for all, I shall never marry." He stayed a little while, considering. Then he said very gently, "Can't you tell me why?"
"I could, but more than anything in the world, I do not want to tell you."
Again he was silent. Then he looked up suddenly, and a singularly attractive smile illuminated his fawn's face. "I see," he said. "So you won't let me come inside the house? Not even to peep in for a second?"
The blinds are to stay down. Allegra leaned forward and laid her hand on his. I will tell you this much. You dream of your house, but I don't dream. My dreams are nightmares. And on that she left him, abruptly, disconcertingly. That night, once more, he dreamed. Of late, he'd realized that the house was most certainly tenanted. He'd seen a hand draw aside the blinds, had caught glimpses of moving figures within. Tonight, the house seemed fairer than it had done ever before. Its white walls shone in the sunlight. The peace and the beauty of it were complete. Then suddenly, he became aware of a fuller ripple of the waves of joy. He knew it. A hand, the same hand that he'd seen before, laid hold of the blind, drawing it back. In a minute he would see. He was awake, still quivering with the horror, the unutterable loathing of the thing that had looked out at him from the window of the house. It was a thing utterly and wholly horrible. A thing so vile and loathsome that the mere remembrance of it made him feel sick. And he knew that the most unutterably and horribly vile thing about it was its presence in that house, the house of beauty. For where that thing abode was horror. Horror that rose up and slew the peace and the serenity which were the birthright of the house. The beauty, the wonderful, immortal beauty of the house was destroyed forever, for within its holy, consecrated walls there dwelt the shadow of an unclean thing. If ever again he should dream of the house, Seagrave knew he would awake at once with a start of terror, lest from its white beauty that thing might suddenly look out at him. The following evening, when he left the office, he went straight to Wetterman's house. He must see Allegra Carr. Maisie would tell him where she was to be found. He never noticed the eager light that flashed into Maisie's eyes as he was shown in, and she jumped up to greet him. He stammered out his request at once, with her hand still in his. Miss Carr, I met her yesterday, but I don't know where she's staying. He did not feel Maisie's hand grow limp in his as she withdrew it. The sudden coldness of her voice told him nothing. Allegra is here, staying with us, but I'm afraid you can't see her. But, you see, her mother died this morning. We've just had the news. Oh. He was taken aback. It's all very sad, said Maisie. She hesitated just a minute, then went on. You see, she died in, well, practically an asylum. There's insanity in the family. The grandfather shot himself. And one of Allegra's aunts is a hopeless imbecile, and another drowned herself. John Seagrave made an inarticulate sound. I thought I ought to tell you, said Maisie virtuously. We're such friends, aren't we? And of course Allegra is very attractive. Lots of people have asked her to marry them, but naturally she won't marry at all. Well, she couldn't, could she? She's all right, said Seagrave. There's nothing wrong with her. His voice sounded hoarse and unnatural in his own ears. One never knows. Her mother was quite all right when she was young. And she wasn't just peculiar, you know. She was quite raving mad. It's a dreadful thing, insanity. Yes, he said. It's the most awful thing. He knew now what it was that had looked at him from the window of the house. Maisie was still talking on. He interrupted her briskly. I really came here to say goodbye and to thank you for all your kindness. You're not going away? There was alarm in her voice. He smiled sideways at her, a crooked smile, pathetic and attractive. Yes, he said, to Africa. Africa? Maisie echoed the word blankly. Before she could pull herself together, he'd shaken her by the hand and gone. She was left standing there, her hands clenched by her sides, an angry spot of colour in each cheek. Below, on the doorstep, John Seagrave came face to face with Allegra, coming in from the street. She was in black, her face white and lifeless. She took one glance at him, then drew him into a small morning room.
Maisie told you, she said. You know.
He nodded.
But what does it matter? You're all right. It leaves some people out.
She looked at him somberly, mournfully.
You are all right, he repeated.
I don't know.
She almost whispered it.
I don't know. I told you about my dreams. And when I play, when I'm at the piano, those others come and take hold of my hands.
He was staring at her, paralyzed. For one instant, as she spoke, something looked out from her eyes. It was gone in a flash, but he knew it. It was the thing that had looked out from the house. She caught his momentary recoil.
You see, she whispered. You see? But I wish Maisie hadn't told you. It takes everything from you.
Everything?
Yes. There won't even be dreams left. For now, you'll never dare to dream of the house again.
The West African sun poured down. The heat was intense. John Seagrave continued to moan.
I can't find it. I can't find it.
The little English doctor with a red head and a tremendous jaw scowled down upon his patient in that bullying manner which he'd made his own.
He's always saying that. What does it mean?
He speaks, I think, of a house, monsieur.
The soft-voiced sister of charity from the Roman Catholic mission spoke with her gentle detachment as she, too, looked down on the stricken man.
A house, eh? Well, he's got to get it out of his head, or we shan't pull him through. It's on his mind. Seagrave! Seagrave!
Wandering attention was fixed. The eyes rested with recognition on the doctor's face.
Look here. You're going to pull through. I'm going to pull you through. But you've got to stop worrying about this house. It can't run away, you know, so don't bother about looking for it now.
All right.
He seemed obedient.
I suppose it can't very well run away if it's never been there at all.
Of course not.
The doctor laughed his cheery laugh.
Now you'll be all right in no time.
And with a boisterous bluntness of manner, he took his departure. Seagrave lay thinking. The fever had abated for the moment, and he could think clearly and lucidly. He must find that house. For 10 years he had dreaded finding it. The thought that he might come upon it unawares had been as great as terror. And then he remembered when his fears were quite lulled to rest, that one day it had found him. He recalled clearly his first haunting terror, then his sudden, his exquisite relief. But after all, the house was empty. Quite empty, and exquisitely peaceful. It was as he remembered it 10 years before. He'd not forgotten. There was a huge black furniture van moving slowly away from the house. The last tenant, of course, moving out with his goods. He went up to the men in charge of the van and spoke to them. There was something rather sinister about that van. It was so very black. The horses were black too, with free-flowing manes and tails, and all the men wore black clothes and gloves. It reminded him of something else, something he couldn't remember. Yes, he had been quite right. The last tenant was moving out, as his lease was up. The house was to stand empty for the present until the owner came back from abroad. And waking, he had been full of the peaceful beauty of the empty house. A month after that, he'd received a letter from Maisie. She wrote to him perseveringly once a month. In it she told him that Allegra Carr had died in the same home as her mother, and wasn't it dreadfully sad? Though, of course, a merciful release. It really had been very odd indeed. Coming after his dream like that, he didn't quite understand it all, but it was odd. And the worst of it was that he'd never been able to find the house since. Somehow he'd forgotten the way. The fever began to take hold of him once more. He tossed restlessly.
course, he'd forgotten. The house was on high ground. He must climb to get there. But it was hot work, climbing cliffs, dreadfully hot. Up, up, up. Oh, he had slipped. He must start again from the bottom. Up, up, up. Days passed, weeks. He wasn't sure that years didn't go by, and he was still climbing. Once he heard the doctor's voice, but he couldn't stop climbing to listen. Besides, the doctor would tell him to leave off looking for the house. He thought it was an ordinary house. He didn't know. He remembered suddenly that he must be calm, very calm. You couldn't find the house unless you were very calm. It was no use looking for the house in a hurry or being excited. If he could only keep calm. But it was so hot. Hot? It was cold. Yes, cold. These weren't cliffs, they were icebergs. Jagged, cold icebergs. He was so tired. He wouldn't go on looking. It was no good. Ah, here was a lane. That was better than icebergs anyway. How pleasant and shady it was in the cool green lane. And those trees, they were splendid. They were rather like, what? He couldn't remember, but it didn't matter. Ah, here were flowers, all golden and blue. How lovely it all was, and how strangely familiar. Of course he'd been here before. There, through the trees, was the gleam of the house, standing on the high ground. How beautiful it was. The green lane, and the trees, and the flowers were as nothing to the paramount, the all-satisfying beauty of the house. He hastened his steps. To think he'd never yet been inside. How unbelievably stupid of him, when he had the key in his pocket all the time. And of course the beauty of the exterior was as nothing to the beauty that lay within, especially now that the owner had come back from abroad. He mounted the steps to the great door. Cruel, strong hands were dragging him back. They fought him, dragging him to and fro, backwards and forwards. The doctor was shaking him, roaring in his ear, "Hold on, man! You can! Don't let go! Don't let go!" His eyes were alight with the fierceness of one who sees an enemy. Seagrave wondered who the enemy was. The black-robed nun was praying. That, too, was strange. And all he wanted was to be left alone, to go back to the house, for every minute the house was growing fainter. That, of course, was because the doctor was so strong. He wasn't strong enough to fight the doctor, if only he could. But stop. There was another way. The way dreams went in the moment of waking. No strength could stop them. They just flitted past. The doctor's hands wouldn't be able to hold him if he slipped, just slipped. Yes, that was the way. The white walls were visible once more. The doctor's voice was fainter. His hands were barely felt. He knew now how dreams laugh when they give you the slip. He was at the door of the house. The exquisite stillness was unbroken. He put the key in the lock and turned it. Just a moment he waited, to realize to the full, the perfect, the ineffable, the all-satisfying completeness of joy. Then he passed over the threshold. The Edge. Claire Halliwell walked down the short path that led from her cottage door to the gate. On her arm was a basket, and in the basket was a bottle of soup, some homemade jelly, and a few grapes. There were not many poor people in the small village of Damer's End, but such as there were assiduously looked after, and Claire was one of the most efficient of the parish workers. Claire Halliwell was 32. She had an upright carriage, a healthy colour, and nice brown eyes. She was not beautiful, but she looked fresh and pleasant, and very English. Everybody liked her, and said she was a good sort.
Since her mother's death 2 years ago, she'd lived alone in the cottage with her dog, Rover. She kept poultry and was fond of animals and of a healthy outdoor life. As she unlatched the gate, a two-seater car swept past, and the driver, a girl in a red hat, waved a greeting. Claire responded, but for a moment her lips tightened. She felt that pang at her heart, which always came when she saw Vivian Lee, Gerald's wife. Medenham Grange, which lay just a mile outside the village, had belonged to the Lees for many generations. Sir Gerald Lee, the present owner of the Grange, was a man old for his years and considered by many stiff in manner. His pomposity really covered a good deal of shyness. He and Claire had played together as children. Later, they'd been friends, and a closer and dearer tie had been confidently expected by many, including, it may be said, Claire herself. There was no hurry, of course, but some day... She left it so in her own mind. Some day. And then, just a year ago, the village had been startled by the news of Sir Gerald's marriage to a Miss Harper, a girl nobody had ever heard of. The new Lady Lee had not been popular in the village. She took not the faintest interest in parochial matters, was bored by hunting, and loathed the country and outdoor sports. Many of the wiseacres shook their heads and wondered how it would end. It was easy to see where Sir Gerald's infatuation had come in. Vivian was a beauty. From head to foot, she was a complete contrast to Claire Halliwell. Small, elfin, dainty, with golden red hair that curled enchantingly over her pretty ears, and big violet eyes that could shoot a sideways glance of provocation to the manner born. Gerald Lee, in his simple man's way, had been anxious that his wife and Claire should be great friends. Claire was often asked to dine at the Grange, and Vivian made a pretty pretense of affectionate intimacy whenever they met. Hence that gay salutation of hers this morning. Claire walked on and did her errand. The vicar was also visiting the old woman in question, and he and Claire walked a few yards together afterwards, before their ways parted. They stood still for a minute, discussing parish affairs. "Jones has broken out again, I'm afraid," said the vicar. "And I had such hopes after he had volunteered of his own accord to take the pledge." "Disgusting," said Claire crisply. "It seems so to us," said Mr. Wilmot. "But we must remember that it is very hard to put ourselves in his place and realize his temptation. The desire for drink is unaccountable to us, but we all have our own temptations, and thus we can understand." "I suppose we have," said Claire uncertainly. The vicar glanced at her. "Some of us have the good fortune to be very little tempted," he said gently. "But even to those people their hour comes. Watch and pray, remember, that ye enter not into temptation." Then bidding her goodbye, he walked briskly away. Claire went on thoughtfully, and presently she almost bumped into Sir Gerald Lee.
"Oh, hello, Claire. I was hoping to run across you. You look jolly fit. What a colour you've got."
The colour had not been there a minute before. Lee went on,
"As I say, I was hoping to run across you. Vivian's got to go off to Bournemouth for the weekend. Her mother's not well. Can you dine with us Tuesday instead of tonight?"
"Oh, yes. Tuesday will suit me just as well."
"That's all right, then. Splendid. Must hurry along."
Claire went home to find her one faithful domestic standing on the doorstep looking out for her.
"There you are, miss. Such a to-do. They've brought Rover home. He went off on his own this morning, and a car ran clean over him."
Claire hurried to the dog's side. She adored animals, and Rover was her especial darling. She felt his legs, one by one, and then ran her hands over his body. He groaned once or twice and licked her hand.
"If there's any serious injury, it's internal," she said at last. "No bones seem to be broken."
"Shall we get the vet to see him, miss?"
Claire shook her head. She had little faith in the local vet.
We'll wait until tomorrow.
He doesn't seem to be in great pain, and his gums are a good colour, so there can't be much internal bleeding. Tomorrow, if I don't like the look of him, I'll take him over to Skippington in the car and let Reeves have a look at him. He's far and away the best man.
On the following day, Rover seemed weaker. Claire duly carried out her project. The small town of Skippington was about 40 miles away, a long run, but Reeves, the vet there, was celebrated for many miles round. He diagnosed certain internal injuries, but held out good hopes of recovery, and Claire went away quite content to leave Rover in his charge. There was only one hotel of any pretensions in Skippington, the County Arms. It was mainly frequented by commercial travellers, but there was no good hunting country near Skippington, and it was off the track of the main roads for motorists. Lunch was not served till 1 o'clock, and as it wanted a few minutes to that hour, Claire amused herself by glancing over the entries in the open visitor's book. Suddenly, she gave a stifled exclamation. Surely she knew that handwriting, with its loops and whirls and flourishes. She had always considered it unmistakable. Even now she could have sworn. But of course it was clearly impossible. Vivian Lee was in Bournemouth. The entry itself showed it to be impossible. Mr. and Mrs. Cyril Brown, London. But in spite of herself, her eyes strayed back again and again to that curly writing, and on an impulse, she could not quite define, she asked abruptly of the woman in the office, Mrs. Cyril Brown, I wonder if that is the same one I know. A small lady, reddish hair, very pretty. She came in a red two-seater, madam, a Peugeot, I believe. Then it was. A coincidence would be too remarkable. As if in a dream, she heard the woman go on, they were here just over a month ago for a weekend, and liked it so much, they've come again. Newly married, I fancy. Claire heard herself saying, thank you. I don't think that could be my friend. Her voice sounded different, as though it belonged to someone else. Presently, she was sitting in the dining room, quietly eating cold roast beef, her mind a maze of conflicting thoughts and emotions. She had no doubts whatever. She'd summed up Vivian pretty correctly on their first meeting. Vivian was that kind. She wondered vaguely who the man was. Someone Vivian had known before her marriage? Very likely. It didn't matter. Nothing mattered. But Gerald. But what was she, Claire, to do about Gerald? He ought to know. Surely he ought to know. It was clearly her duty to tell him. She had discovered Vivian's secret by accident, but she must lose no time in acquainting Gerald with the facts. She was Gerald's friend, not Vivian's. But somehow or other she felt uncomfortable. Her conscience was not satisfied. On the face of it, her reasoning was good, but duty and inclination jumped suspiciously together. She admitted to herself that she disliked Vivian. Besides, if Gerald Lee were to divorce his wife, and Claire had no doubts at all that that was exactly what he would do, he was a man with an almost fanatical view of his own honour, then, well, the way would lie open for Gerald to come to her. Put like that, she shrank back fastidiously. Her own proposed action seemed naked and ugly. The personal element entered in too much. She could not be sure of her own motives. Claire was essentially a high-minded, conscientious woman. She strove now very earnestly to see where her duty lay. She wished, as she'd always wished, to do right. What was right in this case? What was wrong? By a pure accident, she'd come into possession of facts that affected vitally the man she loved and the woman whom she disliked and, yes, one might as well be frank, of whom she was bitterly jealous. She could ruin that woman. Was she justified in doing so? Claire had always held herself aloof from the backbiting and scandal, which is an inevitable part of village life. She hated to feel that she now resembled one of those human ghouls she'd always professed to despise. Suddenly, the vicar's words that morning flashed across her mind. Even to those people, their hour comes. Was this her hour? Was this her temptation? Had it come insidiously disguised as a duty? She was Claire Halliwell, a Christian, in love and charity with all men and women. If she were to tell Gerald, she must be quite sure that only impersonal motives guided her. For the present, she would say nothing.
She paid her bill for luncheon and drove away, feeling an indescribable lightening of spirit. Indeed, she felt happier than she'd done for a long time. She felt glad that she'd had the strength to resist temptation, to do nothing mean or unworthy. Just for a second, it flashed across her mind that it might be a sense of power that had so lightened her spirits. But she dismissed the idea as fantastic. By Tuesday night, she was strengthened in her resolve. The revelation would not come through her. She must keep silence. Her own secret love for Gerald made speech impossible. Rather a high-minded view to take? Perhaps. But it was the only one possible for her. She arrived at the Grange in her own little car. Sir Gerald's chauffeur was at the front door to drive it round to the garage after she'd alighted, as the night was a wet one. He'd just driven off when Claire remembered some books which she'd borrowed and had brought with her to return. She called out, but the man did not hear her. The butler ran out after the car. So, for a minute or two, Claire was alone in the hall, close to the door of the drawing room, which the butler had just unlatched prior to announcing her. Those inside the room, however, knew nothing of her arrival. And so it was that Vivian's voice, high-pitched, not quite the voice of a lady, rang out clearly and distinctly.
"Oh, we're only waiting for Claire Halliwell. You must know her. Lives in the village. Supposed to be one of the local belles, but frightfully unattractive, really. She tried her best to catch Gerald, but he wasn't having any." "Oh, yes, darling." This in answer to a muttered protest from her husband. "She did. You mayn't be aware of the fact, but she did her very utmost. Oh, poor old Claire. Good sort, but such a dump."
Claire's face went dead white. Her hands, hanging against her sides, clenched themselves in anger such as she'd never known before. At that moment she could have murdered Vivian Lee. It was only by a supreme physical effort that she regained control of herself. That, and the half-formed thought that she held it in her power to punish Vivian for those cruel words. The butler had returned with the books. He opened the door, announced her, and in another moment she was greeting a room full of people in her usual pleasant manner. Vivian, exquisitely dressed in some dark wine colour that showed off her white fragility, was particularly affectionate and gushing. They didn't see half enough of Claire. She, Vivian, was going to learn golf, and Claire must come out with her on the links. Gerald was very attentive and kind. Though he had no suspicion that she'd overheard his wife's words, he had some vague idea of making up for them. He was very fond of Claire, and he wished Vivian wouldn't say the things she did. He and Claire had been friends, nothing more. And if there was any uneasy suspicion at the back of his mind that he was shirking the truth in that last statement, he put it away from him. After dinner, the talk fell on dogs, and Claire recounted Rover's accident. She purposely waited for a lull in the conversation to say, "So, on Saturday, I took him to Skippington." She heard the sudden rattle of Vivian Lee's coffee cup on the saucer, but she did not look at her, yet.
"See that man Reeves?"
"Yes. He'll be all right, I think. I had lunch at the County Arms afterwards. Rather a decent little pub." She turned now to Vivian. "Have you ever stayed there?" If she'd had any doubts, they were swept aside. Vivian's answer came quick, in stammering haste.
"I? Oh, no.
Fear was in her eyes. They were wide and dark with it as they met Claire's. Claire's eyes told nothing. They were calm, scrutinizing. No one could have dreamt of the keen pleasure that they veiled. At that moment, Claire almost forgave Vivian for the words she'd overheard earlier that evening. She tasted in that moment a fullness of power that almost made her head reel. She held Vivian Lee in the hollow of her hand. The following day, she received a note from the other woman. Would Claire come up and have tea with her quietly that afternoon? Claire refused. Then Vivian called on her. Twice she came at hours when Claire was almost certain to be home. On the first occasion, Claire really was out. On the second, she slipped out by the back way when she saw Vivian coming up the path. "She's not sure yet whether I know or not," she said to herself.
She wants to find out without committing herself, but she shan't. Not till I'm ready. Claire hardly knew herself what she was waiting for. She had decided to keep silence. That was the only straight and honourable course. She felt an additional glow of virtue when she remembered the extreme provocation she'd received. After overhearing the way Vivian talked of her behind her back, a weaker character, she felt, might have abandoned her good resolutions. She went twice to church on Sunday. First to early communion, from which she came out strengthened and uplifted. No personal feelings should weigh with her, nothing mean or petty. She went again to morning service. Mr. Wilmot preached on the famous prayer of the Pharisee. He sketched the life of that man, a good man, pillar of the church. And he pictured the slow, creeping blight of spiritual pride that distorted and soiled all that he was. Claire did not listen very attentively. Vivian was in the big square pew of the Lee family, and Claire knew by instinct that the other intended to get hold of her afterwards. So it fell out. Vivian attached herself to Claire, walked home with her, and asked if she might come in. Claire, of course, assented. They sat in Claire's little sitting room, bright with flowers and old-fashioned chintzes. Vivian's talk was desultory and jerky.
I was in Bournemouth, you know, last weekend,
she remarked presently. Gerald told me so, said Claire. They looked at each other. Vivian appeared almost plain today. Her face had a sharp, foxy look that robbed it of much of its charm.
When you were at Skippington, began Vivian.
When I was at Skippington, echoed Claire politely.
You were speaking about some little hotel there.
The County Arms, yes.
You didn't know it, you said. I have been there once.
Oh. She don't keep still and wait. Vivian was quite unfitted to bear a strain of any kind. Already she was breaking down under it. Suddenly she leant forward and spoke vehemently.
You don't like me. You never have. You've always hated me. You're enjoying yourself now, playing with me like a cat with a mouse. You're cruel, cruel. That's why I'm afraid of you, because deep down you're cruel.
Really, Vivian, said Claire sharply.
You know, don't you? Yes, I can see that you know. You knew that night, when you spoke about Skippington. You found out somehow. Well, I want to know, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do?
Claire did not reply for a minute, and Vivian sprang to her feet.
What are you going to do? I must know. You're not going to deny that you know all about it.
I do not propose to deny anything, said Claire coldly.
You saw me there that day?
No. I saw your handwriting in the book. Mr. and Mrs. Cyril Brown. Vivian flushed darkly. Since then, continued Claire quietly, I have made inquiries. I find that you were not at Bournemouth that weekend. Your mother never sent for you. Exactly the same thing happened about 6 weeks previously. Vivian sank down again on the sofa. She burst into furious crying, the crying of a frightened child.
What are you going to do? She gasped. Are you going to tell Gerald?
I don't know yet, said Claire. She felt calm, omnipotent. Vivian sat up, pushing the red curls back from her forehead.
Would you like to hear all about it?
It would be as well, I think. Vivian poured out the whole story. There was no reticence in her. Cyril Brown was Cyril Haviland, a young engineer to whom she'd previously been engaged. His health failed, and he lost his job, whereupon he made no bones about jilting the penniless Vivian and marrying a rich widow many years older than himself. Soon afterwards, Vivian married Gerald Lee. She'd met Cyril again by chance. That was the first of many meetings. Cyril, backed by his wife's money, was prospering in his career and becoming a well-known figure. It was a sordid story, a story of backstairs meetings, of ceaseless lying and intrigue.
I love him so,
Vivian repeated again and again, with a sudden moan, and each time the words made Claire feel physically sick. At last, the stammering recital came to an end. Vivian muttered, a shamefaced,
"Well?"
"What am I going to do?" asked Claire.
"I can't tell you. I must have time to think." "You won't give me away to Gerald?"
"It may be my duty to do so."
"No, no."
Vivian's voice rose to a hysterical shriek.
"He'll divorce me. He won't listen to a word. He'll find out from that hotel and Cyril will be dragged into it, and then his wife will divorce him. Everything will go. His career, his health. He'll be penniless again, and he'd never forgive me. Never."
"If you'll excuse me saying so," said Claire, "I don't think much of this Cyril of yours." Vivian paid no attention.
"I tell you, he'll hate me. Hate me. I can't bear it. Oh, don't tell Gerald. I'll do anything you like. But don't tell Gerald."
"I must have time to decide," said Claire gravely. "I can't promise anything offhand. In the meantime, you and Cyril mustn't meet again."
"No, no, we won't. I swear it."
"When I know what's the right thing to do," said Claire, "I'll let you know." She got up. Vivian went out of the house in a furtive, slinking way, glancing back over her shoulder. Claire wrinkled her nose in disgust. A beastly affair. Would Vivian keep her promise not to see Cyril? Probably not. She was weak, rotten all through. That afternoon, Claire went for a long walk. There was a path which led along the downs. On the left, the green hills sloped gently down to the sea far below, while the path wound steadily upward. This walk was known locally as the Edge. Though safe enough if you kept to the path, it was dangerous to wander from it. Those insidious, gentle slopes were dangerous. Claire lost a dog there once. The animal had gone racing over the smooth grass, gaining momentum, had been unable to stop, and had gone over the edge of the cliff to be dashed to pieces on the sharp rocks below. The afternoon was clear and beautiful. From far below there came the ripple of the sea, a soothing murmur. Claire sat down on the short green turf and stared out over the blue water. She must face this thing clearly. What did she mean to do? She thought of Vivian with a kind of disgust. How the girl had crumpled up, how abjectly she had surrendered. Claire felt a rising contempt. She had no pluck, no grit. Nevertheless, much as she disliked Vivian, Claire decided that she would continue to spare her for the present. When she got home, she wrote a note to her, saying that although she could make no definite promise for the future, she had decided to keep silent. The present. Life went on much the same in Damer's End. It was noticed locally that Lady Lee was looking far from well. On the other hand, Claire Halliwell bloomed. Her eyes were brighter, she carried her head higher, and there was a new confidence and assurance in her manner. She and Lady Lee often met, and it was noticed on these occasions that the younger woman watched the older with a flattering attention to her slightest word. Sometimes Miss Halliwell would make remarks that seemed a little ambiguous, not entirely relevant to the matter in hand. She would suddenly say that she'd changed her mind about many things lately, that it was curious how a little thing might alter one's point of view entirely. One was apt to give way too much to pity, and that really was quite wrong. When she said things of that kind, she usually looked at Lady Lee in a peculiar way, and the latter would suddenly grow quite white and look almost terrified. But as the year drew on, these little subtleties became less apparent. Claire continued to make the same remarks, but Lady Lee seemed less affected by them. She began to recover her looks and spirits. Her old gay manner returned. One morning, when she was taking her dog for a walk, Claire met Gerald in a lane. The latter spaniel fraternized with Rover, while his master talked to Claire.
"Heard our news," he said buoyantly. "I expect Vivian's told you."
"What sort of news? Vivian hasn't mentioned anything in particular."
"We're going abroad. For a year, but perhaps longer. Vivian's fed up with this place. She never has cared for it, you know."
He sighed. For a moment or two he looked quite downcast. Gerald Lee was very proud of his home.
Anyway, I've promised her a change.
I've taken a villa near Algiers.
Wonderful place, by all accounts.
He laughed a little self-consciously.
Quite a second honeymoon, eh?
For a minute or two, Claire could not speak. Something seemed to rise in her throat and suffocate her. She could see the white walls of the villa, the orange trees, smell the soft, perfumed breath of the south. Second honeymoon. Never came to escape. Vivian no longer believed in her threats. She was going away. Carefree, gay, happy. Claire heard her own voice, a little hoarse in timbre, saying the appropriate things.
Oh, how lovely! She envied them.
Mercifully, at that moment, Rover and the spaniel decided to disagree. In the scuffle that ensued, further conversation was out of the question. That afternoon, Claire sat down and wrote a note to Vivian. She asked her to meet her on the edge the following day, as she had something very important to say to her. The next morning dawned bright and cloudless. Claire walked up the steep path of the edge with a lightened heart. What a perfect day! She was glad that she'd decided to say what had to be said out in the open, under the blue sky, instead of in her stuffy little sitting room. She was sorry for Vivian, very sorry indeed, but the thing had got to be done. She saw a yellow dot, like some yellow flower, higher up by the side of the path. As she came nearer, it resolved itself into the figure of Vivian, dressed in a yellow knitted frock, sitting in the short turf, her hands clasped round her knees. "Good morning," said Claire. "Isn't it a perfect morning?"
"Is it?" said Vivian.
"I haven't noticed. What is it you wanted to say to me?" Claire dropped down on the grass beside her.
"Oof, I'm quite out of breath,"
she said apologetically.
"It's a steep pull up here." "Damn you!"
cried Vivian shrilly.
"Why can't you say it, you smooth-faced devil, instead of torturing me?"
Claire looked shocked, and Vivian hastily recanted.
"Oh, I didn't mean that. I'm sorry, Claire. I am, indeed. Only, oh, my nerves are all to pieces, and you're sitting here and talking about the weather. Well, it got me all rattled."
"You'll have a nervous breakdown if you're not careful," said Claire coldly. Vivian gave a short laugh.
"Go over the edge? No, I'm not that kind. I'll never be a loony. Now, tell me, what's all this about?"
Claire was silent for a moment. Then she spoke, looking not at Vivian, but steadily out over the sea. "I thought it only fair to warn you that I can no longer keep silence about what happened last year."
"You mean you'll go to Gerald with the whole story?"
"Unless you tell him yourself, that would be infinitely the better way." Vivian laughed sharply.
"You know well enough I haven't got the pluck to do that."
Claire did not contradict the assertion. She'd had proof before of Vivian's utterly craven temper. "It would be infinitely better," she repeated. Again Vivian gave that short, ugly laugh.
"It's your precious conscience, I suppose, that drives you to do this,"
she sneered. "I dare say it seems very strange to you," said Claire quietly. "But it honestly is that." Vivian's white, set face stared into hers.
"My God," she said. "I really believe you mean it, too. You actually think that's the reason."
"It is the reason."
"No, it isn't. If so, you'd have done it before, long ago. Why didn't you?"
"No, don't answer. I'll tell you. You got more pleasure out of holding it over me, that's why. You like to keep me on tenterhooks and make me wince and squirm. You'd say things, diabolical things, just to torment me and keep me perpetually on the jump.
And so they did for a bit, till I got used to them."
"You got to feel secure," said Claire.
"You saw that, didn't you? But even then you held back, enjoying your sense of power. But now we're going away, escaping from you, perhaps even going to be happy. You couldn't stick that at any price. So your convenient conscience wakes up."
She stopped,
panting.
Claire said, still very quietly,
I can't prevent your saying all these fantastical things, but I can assure you they're not true.
Vivian suddenly turned and caught her by the hand.
Claire, for God's sake, I've been straight. I've done what you said. I've not seen Cyril again. I swear it.
That's nothing to do with it.
Claire, haven't you any pity? Any kindness? I'll go down on my knees to you.
Tell Gerald yourself. If you tell him, he may forgive you.
Vivian laughed scornfully.
You know Gerald better than that. He'll be rabid, vindictive. He'll make me suffer. He'll make Cyril suffer. That's what I can't bear. Listen, Claire, he's doing so well. He's invented something, machinery. I don't understand about it, but it may be a wonderful success. He's working it out now. His wife supplies the money for it, of course, but she's suspicious, jealous. If she finds out, and she will find out, if Gerald starts proceeding for divorce, she'll chuck Cyril. His work, everything. Cyril will be ruined.
I'm not thinking of Cyril, said Claire. I'm thinking of Gerald. Why don't you think a little of him, too?
Gerald? I don't care that.
She snapped her fingers for Gerald. I never have.
We might as well have the truth now we're at it. But I do care for Cyril. I'm a rotter, through and through. I admit it. I dare say he's a rotter, too. But my feeling for him, that isn't rotten. I'd die for him. Do you hear? I'd die for him.
That is easily said, said Claire derisively.
You think I'm not in earnest? Listen, if you go on with this beastly business, I'll kill myself. Sooner than have Cyril brought into it and ruined, I'd do that.
Claire remained unimpressed.
You don't believe me?
Said Vivian, panting.
Suicide needs a lot of courage.
Vivian flinched back as though she'd been struck.
You've got me there. Yes. I've no pluck. If there were an easy way...
There's an easy way in front of you, said Claire. You've only got to run straight down that green slope. It would all be over in a couple of minutes. Remember that child last year?
Yes,
said Vivian thoughtfully.
That would be easy. Quite easy, if one really wanted to.
Claire laughed. Vivian turned to her.
Let's have this out once more. Can't you see that by keeping silence as long as you have, you've no right to go back on it now? I'll not see Cyril again. I'll be a good wife to Gerald, I swear I will. Or I'll go away and never see him again. Whichever way you like. Claire!
Claire got up.
I advise you, she said, to tell your husband yourself. Otherwise, I shall.
I see,
said Vivian softly.
Well, I can't let Cyril suffer.
She got up, stood still as though considering for a minute or two, then ran lightly down the path, but instead of stopping, crossed it, and went down the slope. Once she turned her head and waved a hand gaily to Claire. Then she ran on gaily, lightly, as a child might run, out of sight.
Claire stood petrified.
Suddenly she heard cries, shouts, a clamour of voices, then...
Silence.
She picked her way stiffly down to the path. About 100 yards away, a party of people coming up had stopped. They were staring and pointing. Claire ran down and joined them.
Yes, miss, someone's fallen over the cliff. 2 men have gone down to see.
She waited. Was it an hour? Or eternity, or only a few minutes. A man came toiling up the ascent. It was the vicar in his shirt sleeves. His coat had been taken off to cover what lay below.
Horrible,
he said. His face was very white. Mercifully, death must have been instantaneous. He saw Claire and came over to her. This must have been a terrible shock to you. You were taking a walk together, I understand. Claire heard herself answering mechanically.
Yes, they'd just parted.
No, Lady Lee's manner had been quite normal. One of the group interposed the information that the lady was laughing and waving her hand. A terribly dangerous place. There ought to be a railing along the path. Vicar's voice rose again. An accident. Yes, clearly an accident. And then suddenly Claire laughed. A hoarse, raucous laugh that echoed along the cliff.
That's a damned lie, she said. I killed her.
She felt someone patting her shoulder. A voice spoke soothingly. There, there. It's all right. You'll be all right presently. But Claire was not all right presently. She was never all right again. She persisted in the delusion, certainly a delusion, since at least 8 persons had witnessed the scene, that she had killed Vivian Lee. She was very miserable till Nurse Lauriston came to take charge. Nurse Lauriston was very successful with methods. So she told Claire that she was a wardress from Pentonville Prison. Claire's sentence, she said, had been commuted to penal servitude for life. A room was fitted up as a cell. And now, I think, we shall be quite happy and comfortable, said Nurse Lauriston to the doctor. Round-bladed knives, if you like, doctor, but I don't think there's the least fear of suicide. She's not the type. Too self-centred. Funny how those are often the ones who go over the edge most easily. Within a wall. It was Mrs. Lompierre who discovered the existence of Jane Howarth. It would be, of course. Somebody once said that Mrs. Lompierre was easily the most hated woman in London, but that, I think, is an exaggeration. She has certainly a knack of tumbling on the one thing you wish to keep quiet about, and she does it with real genius. It is always an accident. In this case, we'd been having tea in Alan Everard's studio. He gave these teas occasionally, and used to stand about in corners wearing very old clothes, rattling the coppers in his trouser pocket, and looking profoundly miserable. I do not suppose anyone will dispute Everard's claim to genius at this date. His 2 most famous pictures, Colour and The Connoisseur, which belong to his earlier period, before he became a fashionable portrait painter, were purchased by The Nation last year, and for once the choice went unchallenged. But at the date of which I speak, Everard was only beginning to come into his own, and we were free to consider that we had discovered him. It was his wife who organised these parties. Everard's attitude to her was a peculiar one. That he adored her was evident, and only to be expected. Adoration was Isabel's due. But he seemed always to feel himself slightly in her debt. He assented to anything she wished, not so much through tenderness as through an unalterable conviction that she had a right to her own way. I suppose that was natural enough, too, when one comes to think of it. But Isabel Loring had been really very celebrated. When she came out, she had been the debutante of the season. She had everything, except money. Beauty, position, breeding, brains. Nobody expected her to marry for love. She wasn't that kind of girl. In her second season, she had 3 strings to her bow, the heir to a dukedom, a rising politician, and a South African millionaire. And then, to everyone's surprise, she married Alan Everard, a struggling young painter whom no one had ever heard of. It is a tribute to her personality, I think, that everyone went on calling her Isabel Loring. No one ever alluded to her as Isabel Everard. It would be, I saw Isabel Loring this morning. Yes, with her husband, young Everard, the painter fellow. People said Isabel had done for herself. It would, I think, have done for most men to be known as Isabel Loring's husband. But Everard was different. Isabel's talent for success hadn't failed her after all. Alan Everard painted colour. I suppose everyone knows the picture. A stretch of road with a trench dug in it. The turned earth, reddish in colour, a shining length of brown glazed drainpipe, and the huge navvy resting for a minute on his spade. A Herculean figure in stained corduroys with a scarlet neckerchief. His eyes look out at you from the canvas, without intelligence, without hope, but with a dumb, unconscious pleading, the eyes of a magnificent brute beast. It is a flaming thing, a symphony of orange and red. A lot has been written about its symbolism, about what it is meant to express. But Alan Everard himself says he didn't mean it to express anything. He was, he said, nauseated by having to look at a lot of pictures of Venetian sunsets, and a sudden longing for a riot of purely English colour assailed him. After that, Everard gave the world that epic painting of a public house, Romance. The black street with rain falling, the half-open door, the lights and shining glasses, the little foxy-faced man passing through the doorway, small, mean, insignificant, with lips parted and eyes eager, passing in to forget. On the strength of these two pictures, Everard was acclaimed as a painter of working men. He had his niche, but he refused to stay in it. His third and most brilliant work, a full-length portrait of Sir Rufus Hirschman. The famous scientist is painted against a background of retorts and crucibles and laboratory shelves. The whole has what may be called a cubist effect, but the lines of perspective run strangely. And now he had completed his fourth work, a portrait of his wife. We had been invited to see and criticise. Everard himself scowled and looked out of the window. Isabel Loring moved amongst the guests, talking technique with unerring accuracy. We made comments. We had to. We praised the painting of the pink satin. The treatment of that, we said, was really marvellous. Nobody had painted satin in quite that way before. Mrs. Lompriere, who is one of the most intelligent art critics I know, took me aside almost at once. "Georges," he said, "what has he done to himself? The thing's dead. It's smooth. It's... oh, it's damnable." "Portrait of a lady in pink satin?" "Exactly. And yet the technique's perfect. And the care. There's enough work there for 16 pictures. "Too much work," I suggested. "Perhaps that's it. If there was ever anything there, he's killed it. An extremely beautiful woman in a pink satin dress. Why not a colored photograph?" "Why not?" I agreed. "Do you suppose he knows?"
"Of course he knows," said Mrs. Lompriere scornfully.
"Don't you see? The man's on the edge. It comes, I dare say, of mixing up sentiment and business. He's put his whole soul into painting Isabel because she's Isabel. And in sparing her, he's lost her. He's been too kind. You've got to destroy the flesh before you can get the soul sometimes." I nodded reflectively. Sir Rufus Hirschman had not been flattered physically, but Everard had succeeded in putting on the canvas a personality that was unforgettable. "And Isabel's got such a very forceful personality," continued Mrs. Lompriere. "Perhaps Everard can't paint women," I said.
Perhaps not," said Mrs. Lompriere thoughtfully. "Yes, that may be the explanation."
And it was then, with her usual genius for accuracy, that she pulled out a canvas that was leaning with its face to the wall. There were about eight of them stacked carelessly. It was pure chance that Mrs. Lompriere selected the one she did, but as I said before, these things happen with Mrs. Lompriere.
"Ah,"
said Mrs. Lompriere, as she turned it to the light. It was unfinished, a mere rough sketch. The woman, or girl, she was not, I thought, more than 25 or 26, was leaning forward, her chin on her hand. Two things struck me at once: the extraordinary vitality of the picture, and the amazing cruelty of it. Everard had painted with a vindictive brush. The attitude, even, was a cruel one. It had brought out every awkwardness, every sharp angle, every crudity. It was a study in brown. Brown dress, brown background, brown eyes. Wistful, eager eyes. Eagerness was, indeed, the prevailing note of it. Mrs. Lompriere looked at it for some minutes in silence. Then she called to Everard.
"Alain,"
she said,
"come here. Who's this?"
Everard came over obediently. I saw the sudden flash of annoyance that he could not quite hide.
"That's only a daub," he said.
I don't suppose I shall ever finish it.
Who is she? Said Mrs. Lanfrière.
Everard was clearly unwilling to answer, and his unwillingness was as meat and drink to Mrs. Lanfrière, who always believes the worst on principle.
A friend of mine, a Miss Jane Howarth.
I've never met her here, said Mrs. Lanfrière. If she doesn't come to these shows.
He paused a minute, then added,
she's Winnie's godmother.
Winnie was his little daughter, aged 5.
Really?
Said Mrs. Lanfrière.
Where does she live?
Battersea, a flat.
Really? Said Mrs. Lanfrière again, then added, and what has she ever done to you?
To me?
To you. To make you so ruthless.
Oh, that, he laughed. Well, you know, she's not a beauty. I can't make her one out of friendship, can I?
You've done the opposite, said Mrs. Lanfrière. You've caught hold of every defect of hers and exaggerated it and twisted it. You've tried to make her ridiculous, but you haven't succeeded, my child. That portrait, if you finish it, will live.
Everard looked annoyed.
It's not bad, he said lightly, for a sketch, that is. But of course it's not a patch on Isabel's portrait. That's far and away the best thing I've ever done.
He said the last words defiantly and aggressively. Neither of us answered.
Far and away the best thing, he repeated.
Some of the others had drawn near us. They, too, caught sight of the sketch. There were exclamations, comments. The atmosphere began to brighten up. It was in this way that I first heard of Jane Howarth. Later, I was to meet her, twice. I was to hear details of her life from one of her most intimate friends. I was to learn much from Alan Everard himself. Now that they are both dead, I think it is time to contradict some of the stories Mrs. Lanfrière is busily spreading about. Call some of my story invention, if you will. It is not far from the truth. When the guests had left, Alan Everard turned the portrait of Jane Howarth with its face to the wall again. Isabel came down the room and stood beside him.
A success, do you think?
She asked thoughtfully.
Or not quite a success?
The portrait?
He asked quickly.
No, silly, the party. Of course the portrait's a success.
It's the best thing I've done, Everard declared aggressively.
We're getting on, said Isabel. Lady Charmington wants you to paint her.
Oh, Lord, he frowned. I'm not a fashionable portrait painter, you know.
You will be. You'll get to the top of the tree.
That's not the tree I want to get to the top of.
But, Alan, dear, that's the way to make mints of money.
Who wants mints of money?
Perhaps I do, he said, smiling.
And once he felt apologetic, ashamed. If she'd not married him, she could have had her mints of money. And she needed it. A certain amount of luxury was her proper setting.
We've not done so badly just lately, he said wistfully.
No, indeed. But the bills are coming in rather fast.
Bills. Always bills. He walked up and down.
Oh, hang it. I don't want to paint Lady Charmington, he burst out, rather like a petulant child.
Isabel smiled a little. She stood by the fire without moving.
Alan stopped his restless pacing and came nearer to her.
What was there in her, in this stillness, her inertia, that drew him like a magnet? How beautiful she was. Her arms like sculptured white marble. The pure gold of her hair, her lips, red, full lips. He kissed them, felt them fasten on his own. Did anything else matter? What was there in Isabel that soothed you, that took all the cares from you? She drew you into her own beautiful inertia and held you there, quiet and content. Poppy and Mandragora. You drifted there, on a dark lake, asleep.
I'll do, Lady Charmington, he said presently. What does it matter? I should be bored. But after all, painters must eat.
There's Mr. Potts the painter, Mrs. Potts the painter's wife, and Miss Potts the painter's daughter, all needing sustenance.
Absurd boy, said Isabel. Talking of our daughter, you ought to go and see Jane sometime. She was here yesterday, and she said she hadn't seen you for months.
Jane was here?
Yes, to see Winnie.
Alan brushed Winnie aside. Did she see the picture of you?
Yes.
What did she think of it?
She said it was splendid.
Oh.
He frowned, lost in thought.
Mrs. Lompierre suspects you of a guilty passion for Jane, I think, remarked Isabel. Her nose twitched a good deal.
Oh, that woman, said Alan with deep disgust. That woman, what wouldn't she think? What doesn't she think?
Well, I don't think, said Isabel, smiling. So go and see Jane soon.
Alan looked across at her. She was sitting now on a low couch by the fire. Her face was half turned away, the smile still lingered on her lips. And at that moment, he felt bewildered, confused, as though a mist had formed round him, and, suddenly parting, had given him a glimpse into a strange country. Something said to him, "Why does she want you to go and see Jane? There's a reason."
Because with Isabel, there was bound to be a reason. There was no impulse in Isabel, only calculation. "Do you like Jane?" he asked suddenly.
"Oh, she's a dear," said Isabel.
"Yes, but do you really like her?"
"Of course. She's so devoted to Winnie. Oh, by the way, she wants to carry Winnie off to the seaside next week. You don't mind, do you? It will leave us free for Scotland."
"It will be extraordinarily convenient."
It would indeed be just that.
Extraordinarily convenient.
He looked across at Isabel with a sudden suspicion. Had she asked Jane? Jane was so easily imposed upon. Isabel got up and went out of the room, humming to herself.
Oh, well, it didn't matter. Anyway, he would go and see Jane.
Jane Howarth lived at the top of a block of mansion flats overlooking Battersea Park. When Everard had climbed four flights of stairs and pressed the bell, he felt annoyed with Jane. Why couldn't she live somewhere more get-at-able? When, not having obtained an answer, he'd pressed the bell three times, his annoyance had grown greater. Why couldn't she keep someone capable of answering the door? Suddenly it opened, and Jane herself stood in the doorway. She was flushed.
"Where's Alice?" asked Everard, without any attempt at greeting.
"Well, she's not well today."
"Drunk, you mean," said Everard grimly. What a pity that Jane was such an inveterate liar.
"I suppose that's it," said Jane reluctantly.
"Let me see her."
He strode into the flat. Jane followed him with disarming meekness. He found the delinquent Alice in the kitchen.
There was no doubt whatsoever as to her condition.
He followed Jane into the sitting room in grim silence.
"You'll have to get rid of that woman," he said. "I told you so before."
"I know you did, Alan, but I can't do that. You forget her husband's in prison."
"Where he ought to be," said Everard. "How often has that woman been drunk in the 3 months you've had her?"
"Not so very many times. Three or four, perhaps. She gets depressed, you know."
"Three or four? 9 or 10 would be nearer the mark. How does she cook? Rottenly. Is she the least assistance or comfort to you in this flat? None whatever. For God's sake, get rid of her tomorrow morning and engage a girl who's of some use."
Jane looked at him unhappily.
"You won't," said Everard gloomily, sinking into a big armchair. "You're such an impossibly sentimental creature. And what's this I hear about your taking Winnie to the seaside? Who suggested it, you or Isabel?"
Jane said very quickly, "I did, of course."
"Jane," said Everard, "if you would only learn to speak the truth, I should be quite fond of you. Sit down, and for goodness sake, don't tell any more lies for at least 10 minutes.
"Oh, Alan," said Jane, and sat down. The painter examined her critically for a minute or two. Mrs. Lompierre, that woman,
had been quite right. He had been cruel in his handling of Jane. Jane was almost, if not quite, beautiful. The long lines of her were pure Greek. It was that eager anxiety of hers to please that made her awkward. He had seized on that, exaggerated it, had sharpened the line of her slightly pointed chin, flung her body into an ugly pose. Why? Why was it impossible for him to be 5 minutes in the room with Jane without feeling violent irritation against her rising up in him? Say what you would, Jane was a dear, but irritating. He was never soothed or at peace with her, as he was with Isabel. And yet Jane was so anxious to please, so willing to agree with all he said, but alas, so transparently unable to conceal her real feelings. He looked round the room. Typically Jane. Some lovely things, pure gems. That piece of Battersea enamel, for instance. And there, next to it, an atrocity of a vase, hand-painted with roses. He picked the latter up. Would you be very angry, Jane, if I pitched this out of the window?
Oh, Alan, you mustn't.
What do you want with all this trash? You've plenty of taste if you care to use it. Mixing things up.
I know, Alan. It isn't that I don't know. But people give me things. That vase, Miss Bates brought it back from Margate, and she's so poor and has to scrape, and it must have cost her quite a lot. Well, for her, you know. And she thought I'd be so pleased. I simply had to put it in a good place.
Everard said nothing. He went on looking round the room. There were one or two etchings on the walls. There were also a number of photographs of babies. Babies, whatever their mothers may think, do not always photograph well. Any of Jane's friends who acquired babies hurried to send photographs of them to her, expecting these tokens to be cherished. Jane had duly cherished them.
"Oh, who's this little horror?"
asked Everard, inspecting a pudgy edition with a squint.
"Not seen him before."
"It's a her," said Jane. "Mary Carrington's new baby."
"Poor Mary Carrington," said Everard. "I suppose you'll pretend that you like having that atrocious infant squinting at you all day."
Jane's chin shot out. "She's a lovely baby. Mary is a very old friend of mine."
"Loyal Jane," said Everard, smiling at her. "So Isabel landed you with Winnie, did she?"
"Well, she did say you wanted to go to Scotland, and I jumped at it. You will let me have Winnie, won't you? I've been wondering if you would let her come to me for ages, but I hadn't liked to ask."
"Oh, you can have her. And it's awfully good of you."
"Then that's all right," said Jane happily. Everard lit a cigarette.
"Isabel show you the new portrait?"
he asked rather indistinctly.
"She did."
"What did you think of it?"
Jane's answer came quickly, too quickly.
"It's perfectly splendid, absolutely splendid."
Alan sprang suddenly to his feet. The hand that held the cigarette shook.
"Damn you, Jane, don't lie to me."
"But, Alan, I'm sure it is perfectly splendid."
"Haven't you learned by now, Jane, that I know every tone of your voice? You lie to me like a hatter so as not to hurt my feelings, I suppose. Why can't you be honest? Do you think I want you to tell me a thing is splendid when I know as well as you do that it's not? The damn thing's dead. Dead. There's no life in it, nothing behind, nothing but surface, damned smooth surface. I've cheated myself all along, yes, even this afternoon. I came along to you to find out. Isabel doesn't know, but you know. You always do know. I knew you'd tell me it was good. You've no moral sense about that sort of thing, but I can tell by the tone of your voice. When I showed you romance, you didn't say anything at all. You held your breath and gave a sort of gasp.
Alan."
Everard gave her no chance to speak. Jane was producing the effect upon him he knew so well. Strange that so gentle a creature could stir him to such furious anger.
"You think I've lost that power, perhaps," he said angrily, "but I haven't. I can do work every bit as good as romance, and better, perhaps. I'll show you, Jane Howarth."
He fairly rushed out of the flat. Walking rapidly, he crossed through the park and over Albert Bridge. He was still tingling all over with irritation and baffled rage. Jane, indeed. What did she know about painting? What was her opinion worth? Why should he care? But he did care.
He wanted to paint something that would make Jane gasp. Her mouth would open just a little, and her cheeks would flush red. She would look first at the picture, and then at him. She wouldn't say anything at all, probably. In the middle of the bridge, he saw the picture he was going to paint. It came to him from nowhere at all, out of the blue. He saw it, there in the air. Or was it in his head? A little, dingy curio shop, rather dark and musty-looking. Behind the counter, a Jew. A small Jew with cunning eyes. In front of him, the customer. A big man, sleek, well-fed, opulent, bloated, a great jowl on him. Above them, on a shelf, a bust of white marble. The light there and the boy's marble face, the deathless beauty of old Greece, scornful, unheeding of sale and barter. The Jew, the rich collector, the Greek boy's head. He saw them all. The connoisseur. That's what I'll call it, muttered Alan Everard, stepping off the curb and just missing being annihilated by a passing bus. Yes, a connoisseur. I'll show Jane. When he arrived home, he passed straight into the studio. Isabel found him there, sorting out canvases. Alan, don't forget we're dining with the Marches. Everard shook his head impatiently. Damn the Marches. I'm going to work. I've got hold of something, but I must get it fixed. Fixed at once on the canvas before it goes. Ring them up. Tell them I'm dead. Isabel looked at him thoughtfully for a moment or two, and then went out. She understood the art of living with a genius very thoroughly. She went to the telephone and made some plausible excuse. She looked round her, yawning a little. Then she sat down at her desk and began to write. Dear Jane, many thanks for your cheque received today. You are good to your godchild. £100 will do all sorts of things. Children are a terrible expense. You're so fond of Winnie that I felt I was not doing wrong in coming to you for help. Alan, like all geniuses, can only work at what he wants to work at, and unfortunately, that doesn't always keep the pot boiling. Hope to see you soon. Yours, Isabel. When the connoisseur was finished, some months later, Alan invited Jane to come and see it. The thing was not quite as he'd conceived it, that was impossible to hope for, but it was near enough. He felt the glow of the creator. He had made this thing, and it was good. Jane did not this time tell him it was splendid. The colour crept into her cheeks, and her lips parted. She looked at Alan, and he saw in her eyes that which he wished to see. Jane knew. He walked on air. He'd shown Jane. The picture off his mind, he began to notice his immediate surroundings once more. Winnie had benefited enormously from her fortnight at the seaside, but it struck him that her clothes were very shabby. He said so to Isabel. Alan, you who never notice anything! But I like children to be simply dressed. I hate them all fussed up.
There's a difference between simplicity and darns and patches.
Isabel said nothing, but she got Winnie a new frock. 2 days later, Alan was struggling with income tax returns. His own passbook lay in front of him. He was hunting through Isabel's desk for hers when Winnie danced into the room with a disreputable doll.
Daddy, I've got a riddle. Can you guess it? Within a wall as white as milk, within a curtain soft as silk, bathed in a sea of crystal clear, a golden apple doth appear. Guess what that is?
Your mother, said Alan absently. He was still hunting.
Daddy!
Winnie gave a scream of laughter.
It's an egg! Why did you think it was Mummy?
Alan smiled too. I wasn't really listening, he said, and the words sounded like Mummy somehow. A wall as white as milk, a curtain, crystal, a golden apple. Yes, it did suggest Isabel to him. Curious things. Words. He found the passbook now. He ordered Winnie peremptorily from the room.
10 minutes later, he looked up, startled by a sharp exclamation.
Alan!
Hello, Isabel.
I didn't hear you come in. Look here, I can't make out these items in your passbook.
What business had you to touch my passbook?
He stared at her, astonished.
She was angry. He'd never seen her angry before. Oh, I'd no idea you would mind.
I do mind. Very much indeed. You have no business to touch my things.
Alan suddenly became angry too.
I apologize, but since I have touched your things, perhaps you will explain one or two entries that puzzle me. As far as I can see, nearly £500 has been paid into your account this year, which I cannot check. Where does it come from?
Isabel had recovered her temper. She sank into a chair. You needn't be so solemn about it, Alan, she said lightly. It isn't the wages of sin, or anything like that.
Where did this money come from?
From a woman. A friend of yours. It's not mine at all. It's for Winnie.
Winnie? You mean this money came from Jane?
Isabel nodded.
She's so devoted to the child, can't do enough for her. Yes, but surely the money ought to be invested for Winnie.
Oh, it isn't that sort of thing at all. It's for current expenses, clothes and all that. Alan said nothing. He was thinking of Winnie's frocks, all darns and patches.
Your account's overdrawn too, Isabel.
Is it? That's always happening to me.
Yes, but that 500...
My dear Alan, I've spent it on Winnie in the way that seemed best to me. I can assure you, Jane is quite satisfied. Alan was not satisfied. Yet such was the power of Isabel's calm that he said nothing more. After all, Isabel was careless in money matters. She hadn't meant to use for herself money given to her for the child. The receipted bill came that day, addressed by mistake to Mr. Everard. It was from a dressmaker in Hanover Square and was for 200-odd pounds. He gave it to Isabel without a word. She glanced over it, smiled and said,
Poor boy.
I suppose it seems an awful lot to you, but one really must be more or less clothed. The next day, he went to see Jane. Jane was irritating and elusive as usual. He wasn't to bother. Winnie was her godchild. Women understood these things, men didn't. Of course she didn't want Winnie to have £500 worth of frocks. Would he please leave it to her and Isabel? They understood each other perfectly. Alan went away in a state of growing dissatisfaction. He knew perfectly well that he'd shirked the one question he really wished to ask. He wanted to say, "Has Isabel ever asked you for money for Winnie?" He didn't say it because he was afraid that Jane might not lie well enough to deceive him. But he was worried. Jane was poor. He knew she was poor. She mustn't denude herself. He made up his mind to speak to Isabel. Isabel was calm and reassuring. Of course she wouldn't let Jane spend more than she could afford. A month later, Jane died. It was influenza followed by pneumonia. She made Alan Everard her executor and left all she had to Winnie. But it wasn't very much. It was Alan's task to go through Jane's papers. She left a record there that was clear to follow, numerous evidences of acts of kindness, begging letters, grateful letters. And lastly, he found her diary. With it was a scrap of paper. To be read after my death by Alan Everard. He's often reproached me with not speaking the truth. The truth is all here. So he came to know at last, finding the one place where Jane had dared to be honest. It was a record, very simple and unforced, of her love for him. There was very little sentiment about it, no fine language, but there was no blinking of facts. "I know you are often irritated by me," she'd written. "Everything I do or say seems to make you angry sometimes. I do not know why this should be, for I try so hard to please you, but I do believe all the same that I mean something real to you. One isn't angry with people who don't count. It was not Jane's fault that Alan found other matters. Jane was loyal, but she was also untidy. She filled her drawers too full. She had, shortly before her death, burnt carefully all Isabel's letters. The one Alan found was wedged behind a drawer. When he'd read it, the meaning of certain cabalistic signs on the counterfoils of Jane's checkbook became clear to him. In this particular letter, Isabel had hardly troubled to keep up the pretense of the money being required for Winnie. Alan sat in front of the desk, staring with unseeing eyes out of the window for a long time. Finally, he slipped the checkbook into his pocket and left the flat. He walked back to Chelsea, conscious of an anger that grew rapidly stronger. Isabel was out when he got back, and he was sorry. He'd so clearly in his mind what he wanted to say. Instead, he went up to the studio and pulled out the unfinished portrait of Jane. He set it on an easel near the portrait of Isabel in pink satin. The Lompriere woman had been right. There was life in Jane's portrait. He looked at her, the eager eyes, the beauty that he'd tried so unsuccessfully to deny her. That was Jane. The aliveness, more than anything else, was Jane. She was, he thought, the most alive person he'd ever met. So much so that even now he could not think of her as dead. And he thought of his other pictures, colour, romance, Sir Rufus Hirschman. They had all, in a way, been pictures of Jane. She had kindled the spark for each one of them, had sent him away fuming and fretting to show her. And now? Jane was dead. Would he ever paint a picture, a real picture, again? He looked again at the eager face on the canvas. Perhaps. Jane wasn't very far away. A sound made him wheel round. Isabel had come into the studio. She was dressed for dinner in a straight white gown that showed up the pure gold of her hair. She stopped dead and checked the words on her lips. Eyeing him warily, she went over to the divan and sat down. She had every appearance of calm. Alan took the checkbook from his pocket. "I've been going through Jane's papers." "Yes?" He tried to imitate her calm, to keep his voice from shaking. "For the last 4 years, she's been supplying you with money."
"Yes, for Winnie."
"No, not for Winnie," shouted Everard. "You pretended, both of you, that it was for Winnie. But you both knew that that wasn't so. Do you realize that Jane has been selling her securities, living from hand to mouth, to supply you with clothes, clothes that you didn't really need?"
Isabel never took her eyes from his face. She settled her body more comfortably on the cushions, as a white Persian cat might do.
"I can't help it if Jane denuded herself more than she should have done," she said. "I suppose she could afford the money. She was always crazy about you. I could see that, of course. Some wives would have kicked up a fuss about the way you were always rushing off to see her and spending hours there. I didn't."
"No," said Alan, very white in the face.
"You made her pay instead."
"You are saying very offensive things, Alan. Be careful."
"Aren't they true? Why did you find it so easy to get money out of Jane?"
"Not for love of me, certainly. It must have been for love of you."
"That's just what it was," said Alan simply. "She paid for my freedom. Freedom to work in my own way. So long as you had a sufficiency of money, you'd leave me alone. Not badger me to paint a crowd of awful women."
Isabel said nothing.
"Well,"
cried Alan angrily. Her quiescence infuriated him. Isabel was looking at the floor. Presently, she raised her head and said quietly,
"Come here, Alan."
She touched the divan at her side. Uneasily, unwillingly, he came and sat there, not looking at her. But he knew that he was afraid.
"Alan," said Isabel presently.
"Well?"
He was irritable, nervous. All that you say may be true. It doesn't matter. I'm like that. I want things. Clothes, money, you. Jane's dead, Alan.
What do you mean?
Jane's dead. You belong to me altogether now. You never did before. Not quite. He looked at her, saw the light in her eyes, acquisitive, possessive, was revolted, yet fascinated. Now, you shall be all mine. He understood Isabel then, as he'd never understood her before. You want me as a slave. I'm to paint what you tell me to paint, live as you tell me to live, be dragged at your chariot wheels. Put it like that, if you please. What are words? He felt her arms round his neck, white, smooth, firm as a wall. Words danced through his brain, a wall as white as milk. Already he was inside the wall. Could he still escape? Did he want to escape? He heard her voice close against his ear. Poppy. Mandragora. What else is there to live for? Isn't this enough? Love. Happiness. Success. Love. The wall was growing up all around him now. The curtain, soft as silk. The curtain wrapping him round, stifling him a little, but soft. So soft. So sweet. Now they were drifting together, at peace, out on the crystal sea. The wall was very high now, shutting out all those other things, those dangerous, disturbing things that hurt, that always hurt. Out in the sea of crystal, the golden apple between their hands. The light faded from Jane's.
The end.